Hi, welcome. You are listening to the TetraCast, episode 346, being recorded on May 11th, 2024. I am your host, Josh Torres, substituting for your usual host, Brian Vitale. It has been a very, very loaded week of game industry developments, we'll put it. There's a lot that's been happening, so not much on like the actual, a lot of like interesting games came out this week, but it's also been a heavy, heavy week on like news stuff. So joining me on this episode is your usual crew. We have Adam Vitale.
Hello.
You have James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And you have Chao Min Wu.
How's it going?
So this has been quite an interesting week in terms of like just new releases. Not necessarily so much on like new RPGs or like heavy hitting RPGs, rather, but I got a lot of like indie games that have like RPG elements or RPG centric. Like, we'll get into the surprise release of Hades 2 later on in the news, but that just kind of got shadow dropped by Supergiant Games at the beginning of the week. It's like, hey, it's here, and they never mentioned a release date for that game before, so it's out in early access. We're like, oh, it's out. That's okay, sure. We have other games like Animal Well that came out, and that's been, you know, a lot of people had their eye on that game, made by solo developer Billy Basso, and the first published game by Big Mode. We had other releases like Crow Country, and then the 1.0 release of V Rising that people have been actually saying good things about, and so forth.
There's Scriptmaster, 1000X Resist. The funny thing about that, since they both realized, oh shit, there's too many indie games releasing on May 9th specifically, they're like, hey, do you want to do a bundle where it's just, hey, why not buy both of us at the same time and you get us for 30% off, which right. is very funny.
Yeah, so, and I know one of our contributors, Junior, will also be writing a branching path for Crow Country, one of the other indie releases that came out this week as well. So, and
Little Kitty Big City, I think, also was one of them. Just too many games. Actually, yep. Too many games.
I've actually been, it didn't come out this week, but I've had my eye on the purchase button for Chrono Arc, which is a roguelike deck builder that has RPG elements, and people have been saying very, very, very good things about that game. That game has been early access for a long time, and then just came out of early access, and there's been a lot of people that says, hey, this is like one of the best I've ever played of this genre, and they just announced the other day that they have sold over 300,000 copies of
that's
that game.
That's pretty insane.
So even games like that, they're like not really, they don't have really had the public eye, just like they're kind of massive hits behind the scenes, so that's really cool to see. So keeping in that spirit, one of the games that James mentioned is 1000X Resist that I'll talk about in a bit. I've also been playing a game that also came out this week that's off to a really, really great start called Rabbit and Steel. I've talked about this game previously on this podcast. I did an interview back at PAX West last year with its solo developer, Minodev, who was also the developer of Maiden and Steel. And the full release came out this week. It's a really, really interesting game. A lot of people, especially the MMO community of WoW and FF14, just basically call it a raid simulator. You need to, you know, if you get the itch to like just play MMO raids back to back, this is the game for you. What this
Rabbit
game
and Steel, or as I like to call it, raidplan.exe.
Yes. So for people who don't know this game, this is a game that is it is a roguelite where you play as one of 10 classes that are all rabbit girls, but they all have different classes, like the Heavy Blade rabbit girl, the Assassin rabbit girl, Druid, Wizard, so forth. They have these different job classes. 5 of them are unlocked at the start, and 5 of them you unlock over time. And you can play up to 4 players, and when you start a run, essentially, every enemy that you fight is basically a boss. And the boss will play out like an MMO raid where you'll have visual indicators on the screen of like mechanics are about to happen here. You have to kind of make sense of what's happening on the screen, and then find like a safe zone of like, oh, okay, this marker here is going to expand in all ways 3 times, it'll make a bigger circle, and like there's four of them on screen, so you have to kind of calculate, okay, so this will be a safe zone here because all four of them will expand this to this much, so but it won't touch this zone. And then maybe at the same time, you know, the next mechanic will be like, hey, you have to match colors, so everyone will have a different color, so you have to go stand in like the circle color to not get hit by the mechanic and lose health. And health is very valuable because it's not that easy to replenish, especially on higher difficulty and so forth. And the game is like you're all flying and floating around the screen. There's not like a land and air sort of like vertical zone. Like you're all floating in the air, and it's sort of like a shmup as well, as that's Danmaku DNA or like and Toho as well. Of like there'll be some phases where it kind of plays out like, hey, there's like a lot of bullets on the screen, and you have to dodge them as well. And you have like little, just like in commonly in shmup games, there'll be like a little center circle on your player model, and that'll be the hitbox. So it doesn't matter if like any part of that model interacts with like a projectile, but if it hits that little small hitbox on your character, then you'll deplete health. So it's okay if it hits like their head or their feet, that's fine, as long as it doesn't hit that like center zone of your character model, which where it shares that shmup DNA.
It's so funny because like you're describing that as a shmup, as you should, because it is, but it's also exactly how like 14 works, where the only part of you that's a problem is if the very, very center, like the pixel in the center, like right underneath your character gets hit by a mechanic, that's when you get hit. Mm-hmm. So it's literally the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I haven't been playing this, but I've been seeing a bunch of folks on Twitter, like posting these like multiplayer rooms where people are making jokes about like 14 mechanics, stuff like P3S Elmo Strat, which is strange stuff that nobody knows what it means unless you're a 14 raider, in which case you unfortunately know what it means. It's been very funny seeing people on both sides of the aisle, people being like, what the fuck is this? And other people being like, a fucking course PF made its way into Rapid and Steel.
That's funny. That's
my awesome. Favorite one is the Mario Kart. It's like people, you're trying to tell people, it's like you do the Mario Kart strat. You're like, what the hell is the Mario Kart strat?
I mean, yeah, that'd be my response. I'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? So yeah, I mean, I'm not like a huge MMO raider. Like, I used to play Lost Ark back then. I even farther back than that, I used to play like those Korean MMOs that were free to play back then, and so forth. But like, I'm not like a huge MMO raider outside of like, you know, I used to do a lot of Lost Ark, endgame Lost Ark stuff. So it's been fun to see like, you know, how this game manifests. And of course, some of my friends are FF14 players that raid as well. So they're kind of explaining to me like the FF14 parallels of like how, you know, certain patterns of a boss, like they're very much inspired by like certain FF14 bosses. And even in my interview with Minodev, you know, he is an FF14 player and, you know, knows, you know, quite a bit about like how the raid mechanics work in that, how that inspired, you know, his game design in Rabbit and Steel. So it's so as you're playing the game and beating bosses, you do level up in each run, but you always start at level one. And the faster you beat a boss, the more XP and gold that you'll get. So that's how that's calculated. So usually at like the very beginning of like your run, there'll be like a treasure chest after each boss to kind of start getting you sort of geared up, and then it'll be like only like one treasure chest like every three bosses as the farther along you go. And after you beat like a zone at the start of the next area you go to, there'll be a shop, and here in this shop you can spend your gold to either get level loss, because you get 1% to your stats, like your damage per level up. You can replenish health. You can get temporary consumables and stuff. What they're basically are, it's basically items that'll like boost like say your maximum health, but for that entire stage until the next area. So that might be useful for like, you know, you might be tackling a tougher, more trickier area. You might want more DPS on a certain button that your character has, or more health, like kind of, you know, take an extra hit and it would be, you know, fatal for you. And then interestingly enough, you can also spend gold on like upgrades for your skills. So each job has four buttons. They have a primary, a secondary, a special, and a defensive. And the skill economy in this game is very much like almost like a miniature bite-sized way of like how MMO job rotations work, where some characters like the sniper rabbit, for example, will be like, this is the archer class. So if you activate her defensive, it'll power up her primary and supercharge it. So she'll get like a brief invincibility and like erase all projectiles around her when she uses that defensive. But also your next primary shot will be supercharged. Same thing with like the wizard class, where your big button is the special on that. And every use of like either the primary or the secondary has a chance to reset the cooldown on that big button. The thief rabbit has the assassinate backstab, so if they use that button behind a boss, it'll do extra damage because of backstab. And the nice thing about the thief rabbit is that their defensive gives them a buff called vanish temporarily, where they kind of move slightly faster and they're invincible for a few seconds, but it will get cut off if they press a button. So there'll be upgrades, different upgrades like available to them through these shops that would be like, maybe add something like, hey, the chance of this skill resetting is higher, or like, or if you get an upgrade to like your defensive, it might be like, hey, your defensive now grants like these two other buffs to it, or like it grants like your entire party this certain buff when you press it. And then there'll be other upgrades that'll like, you know, make that action economy for a class like more specialized and unique in that sense. So it's a lot to actually like learn, like how to basically optimize like, you know, your playstyle and build as a run progresses. And of course, in these treasure chests that you pick up, there'll be certain items that like synergize better for a rabbit skill set. Like it might give like their primary or secondary a status affliction. Like you can afflict burn or poison with this, and some rabbits or job classes press the primary or secondary more than others. And then there might be like another later item that they get is like, hey, you will get this item will deal more damage if you are inflicting it on a boss or an enemy that is inflicted with a status ailment, you know, stuff like synergy like that. So it's a lot of interesting tools at your disposal that's very, very, very reminiscent of that MMO experience, but just kind of condensed down into like instead of like putting a lot of hours into an MMO to get to like the raid experience, like this is a game that's very much, hey, it is the forefront, the center of the experience. And this is kind of, if you've never experienced like MMO raiding that like that before, because you haven't put in the time to an MMO to experience that, this might be a game that you might want to look into if like you're interested in like experiencing that dynamic without putting like a lot of hours into an MMO.
I wonder how many people are going to play this game having not done like high-end raids in like 14 before, and suddenly you're like, oh, I should do this.
Yeah, exactly. Like this might be their gateway to that. It's like, hey, I actually really like this, you know? And that's really cool. So it seems to be off to a really great start on Steam. I don't know if it's coming to other platforms later, but right now it's available on Steam. And the netcode is great. The developer basically made a custom rollback solution for Maiden and Spell, and then decided to use that same netcode in this game. So they didn't. I'm not saying they invented rollback. They did not. But they, like, you know, you can tweak the rollback netcode to kind of suit your custom needs for a game. So that's the networking solution that they've done. It's been flawless for here. And this game also supports local co-op as well in online lobbies. So I can actually, like, for example, when I go join like a lobby, I can like input like my controller and my keyboard, and I'll register that as two different players. So like if you just wanna even like have a friend with you at your place, and you guys want to play, but you want to play with other people, you guys can actually do local co-op and online lobby. Really awesome. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing, like, I hope that game like kind of just sees more eyes and sees like and gets like an even more massive audience, and like seeing like, hey, this is actually what MMO raiding experience is like at like the higher echelons of it, because as there are there's like four difficulty modes, like easy, normal, harder than lunar, and like and everything above normal has like new attack patterns and new moves, and they get pretty insane. They get really insane. It's a lot of like visual clutter, and like and there'll be a lot of clarity issues for sure. And it'll be either maybe patched to be toned down or be more easily readable, or people will get used to it in time because there's a lot to like take in. I think it's like in that wait and see phase of people where are able to like kind of memorize the way that the game is like conveying incoming mechanics to you, or if that's just like way too much and maybe the developers have to tone it down just a little bit or like make it easily more readable in some way. But you know, it's still kind of like a work in progress in that aspect, but you know, part of the raiding experience is also just like getting used to like what you're seeing, because just like in MMO raids, especially at the highest difficulties, it is very much you have to memorize each and every mechanic. It's not like something that you can like improvise for or like react for the first time. It's definitely something like you either know the fight or you don't. In that aspect, in normal and in some cases in hard, you can kind of improvise a little bit of like if you've never seen a mechanic before. But definitely like in like lunar, for example, just like you either know the mechanic or you don't, and you'll get hit.
Yeah, which is basically the savage tier difficulty in FF14. It's like yeah, either you do know the fight or you can't. You know, you just get killed. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's been my experience with Rabbit, and still it's been cool to see this, you know, come out, even though it's been a really, really busy week for smaller games. It's still great. And I definitely want to check out all the other indie games that came out as well this week.
Yeah. At least for Rabbit and Steel, like already it has like 1,211 reviews, which for an indie game, this has absolutely been a success already for them. I'm glad about that.
Yeah.
Just hope all the other indie games that released this week that weren't published by Donkey or on Game Pass also are successful.
Yeah. Or Supergiant. They're probably fine.
Right.
Is this super mid-game?
Supergiant. We'll get to it, but
are they still indie?
They are, but it's like they had over 100,000 concurrent players for Hades 2. They made their money back on their development within like an hour.
It's like a county of like if Larian Studios is an indie, or
like by, it's by like, a definition they are.
Yeah. But what were you gonna say, Chow?
Is Hollow Knight Silksong an indie game?
I don't know. It depends. Is Silksong a game? I don't know.
What's it got rated by ESRB. It's probably going to be shadow dropped at the Microsoft thing.
Give me a release date, then it becomes a real game.
Yeah. Were you going to say something earlier,
Chad? I was going to say, is this our gateway to mid-game content to FF14? Because people keep playing, there is no mid-game content or mid-tier difficulty content in Final Fantasy 14. Is this our gateway drug?
I wonder if this will catch the eyes of like FF14 raiders who are kind of waiting for the next like big content drop in raiding, and I wonder if they're gonna gravitate toward this game, be like, hey, this is a nice like substitute in the meantime to like learn and play.
I was reading the reviews, and there was like one review saying Dawn Trail waiting room, so I'm pretty sure the answer to that is yes.
Yeah, all the best, you know, to Mino and Dev, and fantastic work. Great job. Another smaller game that came out, and I barely learned about this game, I believe, yesterday.
I only found out about it because of a former contributor to the site, Natalie Flores.
Nice.
She wrote a review for Paste, I believe, for 1000X Resist, which the best way to describe it is it's a narrative style, like, not a visual novel, but it's a narrative style game that's... It's not a walking sim. There is some gameplay, and it's more of I don't know the best exact like comparison, but heavily inspired by Nier Automata, and specifically Hong Kong, like Canadian diaspora, which is interesting.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to really wrap it up in a neat bow, like what it is. But I guess the best way to say it is that this is an alternate universe where in the future, these aliens called the Occupants invade Earth and infect a bunch of people with this disease that causes them to die. But except one girl, Iris, was immune. And so there was a plan to basically repopulate the Earth with her and a bunch of her clones. And that's basically where we're at there. So it's like, what if Yorha and Nier Automata wasn't a bunch of androids, but rather it was a bunch of clones of this one person that was immune to this virus. And there was like a whole plan to try and like take back Earth because they could actually fight back.
Yeah, I was reading the description for this game and it sounded really, really unique. So on top of like these clones, like there seems to be like a hierarchical society that forms around these the clones of this one girl, and there's like certain like higher jobs that like oversee the society, and then your player character is I believe called like the Fixer or
the Watcher,
and they have the ability to like dive into like the dreams or something of like or into the memories of certain members of the society. And there's a whole conspiracy that that begins unfolding and that that manifests at like the very top. And your job is the Watcher because of a certain thing that happens in the game, like a certain event. Like you have to kind of uncover the conspiracy and truth of like what's been going on.
Yes, but also the game makes it very clear what the end result of it is because it has an immediate res where it's like the game cold opens with the Watcher just killing Iris, just straight up killing her.
Okay. So, and then your job is like to piece the clues of like, okay, how did it come to that?
Well, yeah, because you go back and you see like how it all got to there, and then it's interesting. I don't want to say too much because the story does go places even in just like the hour and a half, 2 hours I played. It wears its inspirations on its sleeve. Like it, even if I hadn't told you that it was inspired by Nier Automata, if you played this for like an hour, you would be able to clock it immediately.
Right. I remember some friends of mine like said like they some of them like picked it up on the spot because like I believe the developer Signalis also brought attention to this game, and they're like we're picking it up on the spot. If they like it, they're probably gonna like it.
Yeah. So it's got a really striking aesthetic. One of the things that it does is that each chapter is like slightly different gameplay style, like a slightly different gameplay style. The first main one you do, so you're revisiting Iris's memory of like her high school days, which was the reason that people found out that she was immune, is that one student had gotten the disease and had kept going to school for like 3 or 4 days without telling anyone.
Oh, no.
And it just so happened that people finally found out right during the school dance.
Well.
So one of the things you're doing is that you're going through different like time periods, because there's like you're at the same school, but you're at the time period of like right before Iris becomes like the head of this project, the All Mother. And then you're like seeing the memories of the actual incident, like right before the dance and the dance itself. And then like years later, like decades later of what happened in the end. And it's striking because you can like switch between the different time periods, like with the push of a button. So it's like sometimes, so like there'll be puzzles where it's like, okay, there's something blocking my path in the past, so I need to go to the future. And then you have to switch between them. But it's like, for example, in the courtyard of the school, like in the past, obviously there's a bunch of kids there. They're mostly happy. It's like, it's just like, they don't know what's going to happen. You go into the future, there's a bunch of grave markers. Because they just died. Yeah. And you can just like see that difference in like the push of a button. And then the way that the game uses like those gameplay elements for its storytelling, like environmental storytelling, is really, really striking. Like the second chapter, it's completely different in the sense that it's like completely first person. Like the first chapter, it's like isometric, kind of like in old school, like Resident Evil style. You're going through the school that way.
Oh, okay.
The second one is like first person, and you're basically just like revisiting like Iris's memories of her parents. And then the third chapter, it's like completely side scrolling, kind of like how like Danganronpa 2's like world map would be like. So okay. It's like it's really
that's really cool. I really like when games kind of use like the medium of video games in a way to propel their storytelling. Like I compare it in a way. It's like this is a game that couldn't be done as like a book because of the way it presents itself. It's not something that you can like just put into words and like present a story. You'll kind of get, you know, almost the same experience. There's a way that like makes use of perspective shifts and like gameplay differences, like from chapter to chapter, to present like something that can only really be done in a video game.
Yeah,
interactive wise.
Yeah, I'm enjoying my time with it. I'm going to try and finish it up this weekend, along with all the other indie games I picked up. Too many indie games. Like I said earlier, this was in a bundle of Cryptmaster, and I wrote up a preview for that at Day of the Devs at the end of last year. And I was interested in maybe reviewing Cryptmaster, but I didn't think I'd have the time, so I didn't request the code. So I planned on picking it up regardless, and since this was in a dual pack and I heard such good things, I decided, well, yeah, why not both?
I've also been working on Sandland, which came out a few weeks ago. I'll talk about it more when I complete the game, but I'm at the point where I can go to Forestland now. It's I'll talk about it more when I get done with it. I'm still kind of, I'm not sure how I feel about the game, which is, yeah. It's solid, but it's okay, I'd say. But we'll
yeah,
see.
We'll see. Nothing else I can specifically talk about. It's either under embargo or it's Kuroo no Kiseki 2, which I'm not talking about. That first game's not even localized yet. That's not fair to anyone that's listening. Yeah. But I guess to update folks, I finished up both sides of chapter 1, so I'm heading into both sides of chapter 2. So I think I'm about a third of the way through, maybe a little bit less.
Okay.
Around there. So.
All right. Well, maybe talk in private when you get closer to the end and stuff like that. But cool to see that you're making progress as we inch closer to Kainu Kiseki.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we get into news, because I know Adam is working on some stuff he can't talk about, and Chao is in the Honkai Star Rail vortex. Our article shoutouts, we have FF7 Rebirth's ending is perfect but isn't quite perfect. That is an article that is was written by a contributor, Sorel Kerr Jung. Sorry if I mispronounced their name. I deeply apologize if I mispronounced that. But the thesis is basically saying that like that in their perspective, FF7 Rebirth's ending is basically like it's interesting because it's so messy. There's an intrinsic quality of intentional confusion that makes it more interesting to play out than if it was done like a one-to-one recreation, so to speak. And of course, a lot of we won't go into like, you know, how that game ended, obviously still spoilers, but obviously, you know, a lot of the things that we were presented are presumably going to be answered obviously in the final part of this FF7 remake trilogy. So we're all banking on like part 3 clearing up a lot of the intentional confusion that ending caused.
It drove a lot of people crazy, but I think people jumped the gun a bit too soon when you don't have a third part to compare it with, right? It's like, until the third game comes out, then
we'll see in retrospective, you know, how, you know, what was the vision worth the multi-year wait. We'll see. Moving on to news. So before we start off with news, a lot of these aren't going to be like RPG exclusive or RPG centric. That we're going to start off like a lot of industry news because they are tangentially RPGs, like are related to RPGs, but also like it's kind of an interesting shift in the industry, like the, as you're seeing it from like our perspective. Obviously, it's not mentioned on our document here, but there was, you know, news on Sony's end. There's a Helldivers 2 debacle happening last weekend that, you know, sort of resolved itself, half resolved itself, let's say. But then there's a new one. There's a new debacle with Sony with Ghost of Tsushima's PC release. You know, it's kind of an interesting development going on there. But the summary of that is basically Ghost of Tsushima is not being sold in countries that don't have PSN access, because there's a mandate now on that game where in order to access its multiplayer Legends mode, you need to sign into PSN to access it. So for countries and territories that cannot, that don't have PSN, they won't be able to access that part of the game because of that mandate. But then there's still a big single-player element, but they're still being barred by purchasing it, even though there might be players in those territories that are only interested in the single-player part of that game. So it's kind of a whole messy situation on that end.
I know they want to avoid the Helldivers situation again, but this is such a dumb move, in my opinion. It's like, no one... I don't think I know anybody that plays this game for the multiplayer content. It's mostly
There are people that have to do that. So there are some people that are very fond of the Tsushima's multiplayer content and like say that like the multiplayer is better than the single player in their eyes. So there's definitely some people. It's kind of a weird thing to see because there have been solutions that like services like EA and Ubisoft and other places that like have found a solution to still, you know, sell those games in those territories. You know, despite they might have to being able to sign into something. So it's one of those things that I hope there's a decent solution down the road, because it's not great what the current landscape is in that situation. But that's not really in our wheelhouse, because once again, it's not really RPGs. What is a bit in our wheelhouse, because, you know, we did cover Prey, the recent reboot of Prey, which was in 2017. I forgot the year already. Xbox, earlier this week, Xbox announced that they were shutting down four studios. The four studios are Arcane Austin, Tango Gameworks, Alpha Dog, and Roundhouse Games. So before we kind of untangle this, let's get the facts straight. Obviously, Arcane Austin, they were the developers of that Prey reboot, and most recently last year's Redfall. Tango Gameworks, was the developer behind Evil Within 1 and 2. They did Ghostwire Tokyo, and they did last year's Hi-Fi Rush. The other two Bethesda studios, Alpha Dog and Roundhouse Games. Alpha Dog had a game called Mighty Doom, and that their game Mighty Doom is closing down on August 7th. And then Roundhouse Games, which was, you know, it was formed following the closure of Human Head Studios, did more support work, more so than like release like, you know, their own games, which is still vital support work. The staff of Roundhouse Games will be joining ZeniMax Online Studios, so it's not like all of the staff have been laid off, but for the other three, they've almost all been laid off, if not all of them. I'm not exactly sure if like they retained any talent from those studios. That hasn't been reported yet on like if how many people have been retained, if any, on those.
A couple comments.
Yes.
So Arcane Lyon, set in France, based in France, they're still open, and they're working on Blade, like Marvel Blade game. I don't think we really know anything about it other than it exists. And they were also, Arcane Lyon was also the main developer behind Deathloop.
And Dishonored, right?
Sorry?
What, but did they do Dishonored?
Oh, and Dishonored, well, yes.
Yeah.
But one thing I wanted to say is Harvey Smith, who is basically one of the leads at Arcane, he actually had a really nice, really long tweet thread about basically, I think, what his 16 years at Arcane means to him. And it's really personal and kind of like really introspective of basically what that all meant to him and his team. But one thing that he said that kind of stuck out to me was he basically said that like to a lot of people like to boil it down in that like, oh, Arcane Lyon did these games, Arcane Austin did these games, kind of like trying to like put them in the very clean buckets. But he basically said, you know, these two studios at Arcane collaborated a lot. He's literally moved back and forth between Lyon, France, and Arcane and Austin, Texas, as, you know, a head at Arcane. And basically, he basically tried to put a little bit of a, you know, it's not as clean of a break as some people like to try to make it out.
Right. Yeah.
But for what it's worth, Arcane Leon still does exist and they're still working on Blade. And it just kind of feels like, you know, just half the studio is just gone now. And I, you know, if you've played any Arcane games, I really recommend reading his Twitter thread, Harvey Smith, because he gets pretty personal on it.
I think, and I know we want to keep it to just like the facts. I think it's really kind of depressing that both studios that worked on Prey follow-ups, Prey 2017 and the canceled Prey 2, like the actual Prey 2, both of those studios were shuttered on the same day.
Oh, geez, I didn't know that was that same day. Yeah.
That's not well, yeah, true. Because it's like you said, Human Head were the ones that were working on
Prey 2. I did that was the same day, though. I didn't know that was...
All four of these studios were shuttered on the same day.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't think about that, though. Yeah, because of the Human Head. I forgot they were doing... It's one of those things that's like it's really infuriating to see. But to go over, just I cannot speak to like the latter two with Alpha Dog and Roundhouse Games, because I personally haven't like played Mighty Doom, and I don't know exactly like all the support work that Roundhouse Games has done. So I can't really speak as well. But I know there's gonna be a lot of talk for Arcane Austin of like Prey was excellent, but then a lot of people, you know, didn't like Redfall, and that's fine. That's totally fine to like not like Redfall. It wasn't the hit that they wanted it to be. It did not set the world on fire when it released, and you know, it was not a great release. But you know, just because of one failed like game that what didn't like set the world on fire, as ostensibly, you know, just like a bad release, like one bad release shouldn't be able to like basically wipe the studio off of existence. And I know Microsoft will be like, hey, that wasn't the main reason, because of course they're not gonna say that, but I'm sure it was a major factor in making these decisions and so forth. Of course, a lot of the extension has been to Tango Gameworks, and that's, you know, it's kind of like a shocker to a lot of people, because, you know, the Evil Within games, you know, well received, especially Evil Within 2. And of course a lot of people loved Hi-Fi Rush, and it's kind of this weird thing, because like a game winning awards, like yes, Hi-Fi Rush did win awards, but you know, over everything, you know, Microsoft will want to know like how well it did financially, how successful it was financially.
Well, right? Here's the thing with that. Just to be very clear, yeah. People brought up like Aaron Greenberg's tweets about how he was very explicit that Hi-Fi Rush was a success by every metric. That's not like that's not extrapolating. That's his exact words. Those were his exact words. And prior to this week, Microsoft, Xbox has been training their fans that, look, a game doesn't need to sell well to be successful in the Game Pass world. Before this week, that wasn't a main concern. They released press statements about how, oh yeah, there was like millions of players for Hi-Fi Rush. So when you take what Greenberg said and you look at all of everything else and the fact that the game won rewards, it's not a surprise why people are like focusing on Tango here.
Some follow-up reports from this closure, saying that like, you know, Tango Gamers was in the middle of pitching a Hi-Fi Rush sequel.
And then the day after they got shuttered, you had Matt Booty saying, oh, well, Xbox needs smaller games that win rewards. And it's like, that's what Hi-Fi Rush was. You literally just shuttered the studio. It's, to be blunt, and I'm gonna borrow some of like Jason Schreier's reporting. Basically, the main reason why these studios were shuttered, according to him, and I believe him because he's very consistent on making sure that he reports only the facts, is that it was because these studios didn't have anything currently in production. So from a financials perspective, it's like, well, the money's already been earmarked for all these other studios. Nothing's been earmarked here. So if we shutter these guys, we don't have to worry about any unnecessary expenses within the near future, which, just to be blunt, to be completely clear here, if that is the main thing, the only thing that you're making business decisions on, completely divorced from the fact that Hi-Fi Rush, at the time of its closure, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that with the rough couple of years that Xbox has had, that Tango Gameworks, after Hi-Fi Rush, was the most beloved Xbox Game Studios studio. I don't think that's a stretch.
It's definitely one of their higher profile ones within, like, you know, the gaming communities, for sure, because, you know, it's been hard for Microsoft, especially Xbox, to just kind of win the hearts of people, and then Hi-Fi Rush just kind of feels like that breakthrough moment in that aspect.
Before we get too far off.
Yeah.
You know what other studio laid off people and closed studios because the games were too far out? Like, they wouldn't contribute to revenue immediately.
Embracer.
Embracer.
Embracer. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's. I don't think, even if it's an opinion, I don't think it's unreasonable to say that the decision to shutter Tango, considering everything and especially the backlash, that was a mistake. It has to have been a mistake.
Yeah, I agree. And then there's a follow-up interview with head of Xbox, Sarah Bond, from Bloomberg, trying to kind of get more insight from her about, like, the reason behind this closure, especially Tango Gameworks. And, you know, her response was, I would say, let's just say, a non-answer. A lot of people would say it's a lot of word salad. But the key components of that answer was, like, you know, their measure of success and Microsoft's measure of success was fundamentally different. Even though they considered it success back then, I guess now Microsoft, you know, not enough of a success to kind of get them to pitch a new title and support it. And of course, you know, as you have already pointed out during this interview, during that answer, they pointed up a shot of the bar graphs of Microsoft's year-over-year profit, and the trends it was trending towards where it went up, and now it's slightly starting to go down. So it's like, oh, there's the real answer right there. That's the reason why.
But they're still making record-breaking profits.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
they're still making profits.
Microsoft is still a $3 trillion company, and of course Xbox, you know, is very, very, very wealthy. But, you know, the bar is going down. Uh-oh. So it's not great. And this has not been going well for anyone. No one has been supportive of this whatsoever. Even executives or even a staff on social media from Tango Gameworks. I forgot exactly which staff member from Tango Gameworks, but took a picture of, like, all the awards that Hi-Fi Rush one, and then they just said, this isn't enough.
Yeah, they quote retweeted, like, the Matt Booty quote, which, I'm just gonna be blunt, if you can't read the room that much and you're basically like firing a whole fucking magazine into your foot with that statement, why does he still have a job? That is such an embarrassing blunder. Like, yeah, out of everything else in the situation, it's like, and where's Phil Spencer? Where's Phil Spencer? Every time there's been some sort of, like, a controversy with Xbox over the last several years, he's been right out in front of it saying something, anything to try and, like calm things down. This whole thing started at the beginning of the business week, and he was radio silent for the entire rest of the business week. It's striking because it's the first time this has happened.
And then, you know, and then you saw that Xbox event happening next month, you know, that what used to be E3 is no longer E3. You know,
E3, if you will.
they have their, they'll be up there on stage or their event and be like, yep, we support developers, 2 thumbs up, check out these. And, you know, I imagine, and we, you know, a lot of people have talked about this, but for studios like Ninja Theory, for example, with Hellblade 2 coming up, it's like, what do they think about this?
They've trended several times over this week, and you don't need to like check those tweets to know what people are talking about. It's like Hi-Fi Rush was a $40 game on a smaller budget that was developed by a smaller team. Oh hey, what's Hellblade 2?
Maybe more specifically relevant to RPGs, they have Obsidian and In Exile. Those are not gigantic studios. I mean, I think Obsidian is decently sized, but they're not, you know.
Obsidian has Avowed and Outer Worlds 2 in development, and then you have In Exile with Clockwork Revolution.
I think that out of all of these smaller studios that people are worried about, I'm least worried about Obsidian, specifically because of the fact that they also have Outer Worlds 2. So it seems like Microsoft isn't going to like try and shutter studios that have projects in the tank. And also with the whole Fallout TV series thing and the fact that like Microsoft wants more studio, like they want a Fallout game sooner, Obsidian would be the obvious like one to do it, especially after Avowed is done, because it's like, well, you're still working on a project, but a bunch of your team also is now available. Let's have you make Fallout 5 or something. Since
what's also sort of funny is In Exile also got Fallout DNA, classic Fallout.
Either way, it's like, I'm not going to say they're not going to get shuttered, especially since we're hearing like rumblings that this is not the end of it. There's going to be even more restructuring coming out of Microsoft in the weeks and months ahead. So hopefully Obsidian and Exile are safe. This is depressing, but I don't foresee Ninja Theory making it out of this.
I mean, I hope they do. I mean, it's too early to call, obviously, but it's going to be a real rough one.
To be clear, I hope they make it out of it. It's just it's like people have crunched the numbers, and it's very clear that as far as Microsoft is concerned, it's like buying Activision Blizzard was a mistake.
Yeah, there's kind of the our worries, like, you know, when you first heard word that Microsoft was buying Activision Blizzard, it's like, wow, there's a lot of money. What's the actual real cost behind this? Like, what's it gonna take to like recoup this?
Yeah,
you know, seeing it now. We're seeing the fallout of that.
And credit where it's due. I have some buddies that also run a gaming podcast that have for years have been like talking about how they've been very like reticent about is reticent the right word? They've been very like reluctant. Yeah, they've been very reluctant to believe everything that Microsoft's Xbox division has been saying about the whole like Game Pass and acquisition stuff and how it would be like viable in the future. And they've been saying the same things with when the Activision Blizzard stuff was happening. It's like, we don't think this is going to go through. We think that some like countries like going to stop this. But even if it does, this is just going to be a mistake because it's going to cause the brand to collapse under the weight of itself. And lo and behold, we're starting to see what looks to be like, well, yeah.
We've got reports like, yeah, that, like, you know, well, some of the factors contributing to this. Definitely one is that purchase of Activision Blizzard, like that astronomical cost of, I forgot exactly what the number was already, is like,
$70 billion.
$70 billion.
Jesus. The biggest corporate merger in history.
Yeah, it's so much money. It's unfathomable. And two, you know, there's been reports that like Game Pass is starting to plateau. There's not really much explosive growth behind Game Pass anymore. More, it's reached that plateau. It's not going to really see any more, you know, sudden growth. If anything, it's going to decline.
It's funny about that because like one of the last major bumps to Game Pass was fake, because what they did is they rebranded Xbox Live Gold to Xbox Game Pass Core. But now they can say, oh, well, Xbox Game Pass suddenly got like 15 million new subscribers. And it's like, no, you just rebranded Xbox Live Gold. So you can say that. You're not actually getting new subscribers. That money is just being shuffled around. Yeah. Which is,
I don't know how Xbox gets turns it around on the, after this one.
They don't. They go third party, which I hope that works out, but what got them in this situation in the first place, the reason why they kept acquiring studios, is that inherently the way that Microsoft handles game development with the whole like 18-month contractor policy and all that shit is just antithetical to making video games in a timely manner that are actually good.
Yeah, yeah. I was joking with friends. I was like, they want Falcom, man. Falcom makes games yearly.
Can you imagine?
It'd be a dark day for everyone if that actually came to fruition. But it's just, they're expecting an unreasonable schedule for game development for these to get through. So
it's unsustainable. I mean, games are just taking like way longer to make compared to before. So
people have been saying it for years that like they don't know what's gonna have to give for AAA development to actually like kind of be reasonable again.
Yeah, it's funny because I was reading up on it because a buddy of mine actually found like some evidence that like that whole contractor's policy has been around for at least like a decade and a half, because you can look at some quotes from around when Lost Odyssey was being developed, and they said, oh yeah, so even if you say it had like a $150 million budget, there was also a separate thing called headcount, which meant that you could only have a certain number of permanent staff, and then the rest had to be contractors. And it's like, my God, this has been around since then?
That's crazy.
And then you think about it, it's like, you know what, that makes sense. It wouldn't have been as much of an issue back when when the average dev cycle for a game was 3 to 4 years instead of 6 to 7.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean that's the current state, and you know they've said this is not the end of these cuts. So we'll see what's going to happen in the future for Xbox. What else they're going to do to restructure, I guess. And yeah, that's all the for Xbox's developments this week. We'll see what the following weeks and their event next month has to say. This is a bummer, man. This is not good at all. Moving on, Nintendo had something to say this week. They weren't closing studios. Nintendo was not closing studios, but they did have something to say. Nintendo President Shintaro Furukawa made a statement. He said, "This is Furukawa, President of Nintendo. We will make an announcement about the successor to Nintendo Switch within this fiscal year." So that'll be, which ends on March 31st of next year. It will have been over 9 years since we announced the existence of Nintendo Switch back in March 2015. We will be holding a Nintendo Direct this June regarding the Nintendo Switch software lineup for the latter half of 2024, but please be aware that there will be no mention of the Switch successor during that presentation. So this will be the first official time that Nintendo's got it out to the public and says, hey, we're making a Switch 2, or a Switch successor, rather.
And, I think people said there's like leaked specs recently, thanks to like shipping labels or something like that.
Oh yeah, I haven't looked into that at all.
Yeah, I know they're there, but I don't really care.
Yeah. So some internet sleuths on this board, Family Boards, which is a spinoff of Reset Era, which is dedicated to Nintendo discussions. They've been basically looking for any trace of what might be the Switch 2, or I guess the Switch successor. And they've pinpointed like shipments of components, which as far as they can tell, and other people have come out and said that it lines up with what they've heard, should be the Switch 2 specs. So Digital Foundry did a video like I think late last year going over what they believe to be the Switch 2 specs. And long story short, their assumption seems to have been correct. So it's like, if you go back and watch that video, it'll give you a good idea of what the Switch 2 is capable of, not accounting for, like, obviously, optimizations. But it has, like, 12 gigabytes of RAM, 8 ARM cores, which we don't know too much about how they're going to be clocked. We don't know too much about how they're going to compare to like the CPUs and the current gen consoles, but they could be closer than people think, considering that on the low to mid end, ARM CPUs are pretty competitive these days, especially considering you look at like the Apple Silicon and whatnot.
What would be the closest comparison for people like who can't like really make sense? Like what modern device today would be like this to be the closest to?
People have been saying that in docked mode would be in between a PS4 Pro and an Xbox Series S.
Okay. Which made the comparison. They're like, I was like asking a friend, I was like, how does this compare with consoles? It's like, imagine a PS Pro is a Cell from Dragon Ball, and this is Super Saiyan 2 Gohan.
Yeah, to put in perspective, though, PS4 Pro and an Xbox Series S are already relatively comparable. So, like, having that slot right in between there. The thing this tells me is that if that CPU is capable enough, and considering this has 12 gigabytes of RAM, which is more than what the Series S has, if that CPU is capable enough, there is basically no reason why any game that can run on an Xbox Series S can't run on a Switch 2.
I guess it's important for people to like obviously there's a lot of speculation of like what the final specs are going to be for this successor, but it's important to like kind of get a sense of like what the Switch successor specs are going to be, because if the, you know, we're assuming this
going to be the baseline.
The successor is going to probably sell really, really well, and this will probably be at the baseline of development moving forward of like, hey, people are no longer like designing games with the Switch in mind, Switch specs in mind. They can now like bump up their tech during development and, you know, have the Switch successor instead be that leading platform when it comes to like the development target.
Yeah, let me put it this way. If let's say GTA 6 is like 1080p on an Xbox Series S, maybe it's probably going to be a little bit lower than that. If it's 1080p on an Xbox Series S, there's very little reason, assuming the CPU is comparable, which we don't know yet, but it's very possible, there would be very little reason why that couldn't run on the Switch 2. Which is, that's crazy to think about.
So we will learn more about this thing sometime before the end of next March.
I'm going to assume it's going to be similar to what happened with the Switch 1, where we're going to get proper details in the fall, full blowout in January, and that's going to release before the end of the fiscal year. Because the Q&A for their fiscal year translations were released last night, and we got a bunch of new information. Like somebody specifically asked, it's like, hey, this number of units you're trying to ship seems pretty like aggressive, considering we're in the eighth year of the Switch and the software lineup as of right now seems a bit barren. And you just straight up asked, does this account for the Switch successor in those numbers? And Furukawa said, no, it doesn't. We'll have more information on basically like once it gets properly announced, if it is coming this fiscal year, which I personally believe is inevitable, we'll get updated numbers there.
It's worth mentioning that Nintendo is somewhat notorious for always updating their fiscal forecasts like every year.
Yep.
So like anything they say now about their plans for this year will probably change. Because they do it all the time. They update like their sales forecast and their revenue forecast and, you know, number of units sold and everything. They do it every year.
Yeah. This isn't specifically about games, but one thing that stood out to me from that Q&A was a shareholder asked if there was plans for, I believe it's Nintendo Productions, which is the company, the division they founded for like working on like films and whatnot, so like Mario movie and the upcoming Zelda movie. They asked, is there any plans for Nintendo Productions to work on stuff other than full feature-length films like shorts or animated series? And Furukawa just straight up said, yeah, they're working on stuff like that. We don't have anything to share about what specifically that means yet, but smaller scale stuff is something that they're working on, which means either some sort of shorts for like Nintendo properties or animated series are in the works, which is interesting.
Yeah,
we might get the F-Zero anime again.
Yeah, a lot of companies are going more and more into like multi-genre media or whatever in terms of having these show tie-ins, movie tie-ins, things like that. I mean, we literally are coming off of Fallout being a very, very successful show on the Western side and bringing life into basically all the Fallout games. You have the Sonic movie. Witcher a couple of years ago brought significant gains to the Witcher franchise for CD Projekt. Obviously, the Mario movie. So there's a lot.
Yeah, they had an anime series for the Atelier Ryza that other not too long ago.
Look, I mean, yeah, Square Enix tried this a long time ago, and I don't think they have a successful cross-media project. Does anyone remember that sequel to Final Fantasy V anime? Legend of the Crystal?
Oh, yeah, of course.
But I mean, even more recent, like they had a Legend of Mana anime series. So, you know, so more and more companies are doing it. Still in development, I believe there's like still a Zelda movie that they are working on. Yeah, there's a Zelda
movie.
Did they announce another Mario movie?
Yeah, they did. They did announce that there is a follow-up in production. Okay. So, yeah.
We're still going, proceeding with that. So, yeah, as we're moving into fiscal year results, a lot of Japanese companies announced their fiscal year reports throughout the week. And since we're on Nintendo, Adam, how's Nintendo doing?
I think I mentioned last week that we were basically in the quiet period, and then some companies started releasing results like Koei Tecmo. But, you know, this week, I think we got financial results for Nintendo, Sega, Capcom, and then even on the Western side, we got EA. I think Marvelous also did. Now, some of these aren't fully translated. Nintendo, I mean, their sales are up year over year, their profits up year over year. And I don't know if there's anything especially interesting outside of the fact that they are mentioning or heavily hinting that there's going to be a successor to the Switch very, very soon. We got like some sales updates on some games like Super Mario RPG, most relevant to us, shipped 3.3 million units with 2.6 of that sold through to consumers, which is sort of interesting because Nintendo is like one of the only companies that actually gives sell-through numbers anymore.
Yeah.
Rather than just ship to retailers. And, you know, you can go through all the, you know, they update their how many games sold a million units every fiscal year. But, yeah,
They're still selling a lot of Zelda there, year over year.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of really stuck out to me throughout the fiscal year results for that. But, yeah, I mean, that, like you said, nothing too exciting in that aspect, and you did put an article up for on the Nintendo's fiscal year results.
Yeah, let me count here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I think they have 20 games that have sold more than a million units this fiscal year, which is kind of crazy. Wow. And some of those are like Breath of the Wild sold another 2 million units this year. Just an easy 2 million. No big deal, right? For a game that's 5-6 years old.
I think the craziest thing that came out of their financials was that their profits during the Switch years combined is more than the previous profits of the 35 years prior to it combined, which is insane.
That's wow.
it's like over here on the Western side of things, the industry is, to be blunt, on fire. And then you look at Nintendo and it's like, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens when the Switch 2 hits, because like with the Switch, it took a while for like developers to support it because they were coming off the Wii U. That's not going to happen with the Switch 2. As long as it immediately sells, like people are going to immediately support it because it's a follow-up to the Switch.
So I saw somebody mention, I forget who it was. They were like, they were kind of implying that Zelda was like a massive success and Super Mario Wonder was like a disappointment. And it's like, no, Super Mario Wonder sold 13 million games. Like, sure, Zelda sold 20 million, like Tears of the Kingdom, but like Super Mario Bros. Wonder, 13 million.
That's 13 million a bad number now to some people?
Yeah. Like, it's obviously crazy. It's a platformer, so, you know, it's not going to have like thought, you know, think pieces dropped about like what it means or whatever, but it's a very well selling game. It's not like a story centric or whatever, or whatever.
Time to write up fucking op-eds about Super Mario Wonder.
Yeah. But anyways, like, yeah, some of the games I'm looking at, these 20 that have sold over a million this year, like Princess Peach is over a million. Mario versus Donkey Kong came out a couple months ago, is over a million. The Kirby game that came out, what was it, last year? Forgotten Land sold another million. Super Mario Party, Mario Odyssey sold another 2 million. Like, these Nintendo games have legs, and as we know, they're also being probably sold at close to full price because Nintendo rarely goes on sale
ever.
Nintendo's even able to like maintain like that level of like prestige among people to like even if it's not on discount, they'll still get it.
I think they just have that reputation that they know they're not going to be on sale. So people are like, yeah, I just going to have to buy it regardless. Instead, like some people are like buying other games. They're like, I'll just wait for a sale.
By the way, Mario Kart 8 Deluxe sold another 8 million units this year.
Jesus Christ.
If you don't have it in front of you, do you want to guess how many Mario Kart 8 has sold? Like total?
Combined with Deluxe?
Just have Deluxe in front of me. So
60 million.
It's like 62 million. It's their best-selling Switch game. Like totally. That's a lot.
Yeah, that's kind of hilarious to think about. I'm just thinking, like, when the Switch first
Remember when the pie chart comparing Mario Kart sales, that whole debacle?
Oh, yeah, Polygon.
yeah. Oh, boy. Yeah. And wasn't, like, the attach rate for, like, Mario Kart 8 on the Wii U also, like, something ridiculous, like 60 or 70%? It's like,
I believe it.
Yeah. But I'm just thinking, like... Does anyone remember when the Switch first announced and then the shareholders like thought this was like a stupid idea and the stock price for Nintendo dropped? Man, those guys must be kicking themselves.
Yeah, because like you have to remember, like, you know, like they were coming out off of the Wii U getting to Switch, so it was very iffy for Nintendo. Like, the 3DS was like, you know, it was still maintaining even though it had a rough start. You know, Wii U, not a great time for Nintendo. Adam, what other fiscals do you want to talk about? Because I know you put up Twitter threads and I like reading them about it. So there's a lot of.
Okay, so Sega released their financials, and in terms of unit, like in terms of sales, this was their best quarter in the last many years, which sort of makes sense because they released like a Dragon 8. Persona 3 Reload, and Unicorn Overlord. Plus, they are doing really well on like the mobile front also. I've asked this before. You know what one of their highest revenue games is right now? It's the Hatsune Miku
Persona
game.
Gacha game?
No, it's the Miku gacha game. Colorful Stage or whatever. Whatever it's called. Like that. Right. And so like in terms of sales, this is one of their strongest years. And then, one second, here... So this is the start of a new, like, so a lot of Japanese publishers do they kind of group their fiscal years into groups of three, and they call that like a medium-term plan. And they're actually going into their next medium-term plan for the next 3 years, which they're calling Welcome to the Next Level, which is sort of fun. And
it's a really bad like presentation slide for that Welcome to the Next Level.
Yeah, it's like kind of amusing.
It's not good.
But basically, to kind of boil it down, a lot of this isn't really new. But Sega is their main franchises right now. Like the three that they consider their biggest three most impactful franchises are Like a Dragon, Persona, and Sonic. And then if there was a fourth, you know what the fourth would be? Total War. Now Sega's financials this year, a lot of it have to do, if you want to be like really reductionist about it, it's Japan good, Europe bad.
I mean
it's there's sort of truth to that.
That's what the numbers say.
They sold Relic Entertainment to some like I don't know private equity firm or something. And they're reorganizing some of their European division. And for their next medium term, one of their goals is to basically like reshape their European division and try to like get that back up to snuff because that's what's struggling right now. And then, of course, for the upcoming year, they're really focused on Sonic because they had that Knuckles show, speaking of multimedia, on Paramount. There's a new Sonic movie coming out this year. There's a new game. Well, it's Sonic Generations.
They're having their year of Luigi. There's the year of Shadow.
For them. They're literally calling it not the year of Shadow, but the fearless year of Shadow.
Holy shit!
Fearless in all caps. Also, so they're really focused on Sonic, especially for multimedia. Sonic's probably one of their biggest. But then they, in terms of video games, it seems like they're really, really focused on Metaphor. They expect Metaphor to do really well, Metaphor ReFantazio. And yeah, so I'm looking at their numbers here. So yeah, sales are up. Their income is down over years, and that's basically due to Europe. So they didn't do as well in terms of income this year because of Europe. I'm being a little bit
reactionist. Are there any updates to the Super game?
Oh, they actually don't really focus on it much. Hmm. They bring it up in like literally the second to last slide, basically saying that the Super game, I'll just quote them here. Willingly promoted as a challenge to build long-term growth pillars from a portfolio perspective. Under development while balancing strict checks of work progress or product in process and the appropriate investment level. Full-scale contribution to earnings is expected from fiscal year 2028. So that's still like 3 years out before they expect meaningful earnings from it. So it's kind of...
Damn, what is the Super game? I thought it was canceled. I thought it was like some stupid NFT project.
I have to imagine it's like they're trying to do like their own version of Fortnite or something. I don't know. Lastly, they had just one little quick slide on Persona 5, the Phantom X or the Phantom Cross or whatever it is. The mobile game that was recently released in China and Korea. It's kind of boring. They just say starting off as expected, so not too high, not too low. And then
doing like very well there, like in terms of like just people who are doing metrics on that end on like how it's doing over there in those territories. Seems to be a very strong start.
But they say further expansion in Japan, because it's not out in Japan yet, and global is under consideration.
So it's amusing too because that game has Japanese
dubs, right?
Yeah.
Whole game's dubbed, then you're like, oh, it's technically translated already, right?
Yeah, just put that text into the subtitle and there you go. And you just need the menus
or not. All right, child. If it comes out, if it's in English, please, are you a Persona 5 the Phantom X player?
No. I don't like Persona 5 that much. If it's Persona 3, yeah, go ahead. Persona 5, I have a terrible experience because I spent 500 hours writing guides on it, and I don't want to touch
understandable.
It
okay, you know what? Understandable. Like, if I had to write a guide for Persona 5, I too would never want to touch a Persona game ever again.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Surrounding the release of Persona 5, the Phantom X, one of the things I learned about the Chinese language during it is they have a phrase for Persona 5 is whenever they refer to Persona 5, It translates into like Persona 5 is the best game under the sun because a lot of Chinese players like really, really highly revere that game over there. So that is a phrase that I learned regarding that release. Yeah. So that's a lot of very, very popular over there in China.
I heard the game has a lot of comparison to like HoYoverse games. Like, it has like a similar like gacha mechanics and it even has like a roguelike mode. That's like similar to Simulator Universe from.
Yeah, I think it gets a lot of its cues from Honkai Star Rail. I kind of keep an eye like it's like its patching or an update cycle. And like it seems like almost as updated as like a Honkai Star Rail schedule. It feels like every other week there's like a new update for that game. It's like, oh, it's a new update.
I'm trying to find. There's like an article from like their producer, I think it was like David Jiang or something like that, and I think he even mentions that it's also inspired by Trails as well. I don't know, it's like, you gotta find an article.
I really wonder, like, you know, how well that would do in the West if it got a Western release, because, you know, obviously, traditionally, in the West, mobile games have been, like, they've been kind of fickle, like, it seems like HoYoverse has managed to, like, breach that, you know, that barrier. And I wonder if this Persona game would be able to do it the same way that HoYoverse does, be able to like kind of breach that broader audience in the West, because traditionally most mobile games can't do that.
I think the thing that HoYoverse has is like they have insane budget because of the success from Genshin, and then they could use all that budget to like do more marketing than ever, which is like, you know, not everyone has that kind of luxury, right? So they just keep growing bigger because of their insane budget.
Yeah. Marketing like reaching a goal to stream a Honkai Star Rail for 15 minutes on Discord, right, Chao?
Yeah,
Several other companies put out fiscal year reports in this last week, including one of our very favorite companies, Electronic Arts. So,
oh boy,
that was a joke.
Oh boy,
do we have to talk about this?
No, I mean, to be honest, Electronic Arts is kind of boring. Like 80% of their fiscal stuff is like, here's all of our sports games, which are basically live service games now, right? The only thing interesting about their reports really is that they have two, quote, unannounced games coming out this year. One of them they call like an owned IP game, and one of them they call a partner title coming out quarter four, which is next January to March. The owned IP game is very, very likely Dragon Age. Some people have even just said, like Jeff Grubb, yeah, it's Dragon Age, which you almost don't need like insider knowledge to kind of even guess that. If you were to guess a game, what could it possibly be? That's probably what would come to the top of the list. So Dragon Age is, of course, relevant to us. It's been announced. They say it's unannounced, but they could just mean it hasn't really been announced for a year yet. But also, even though it's been announced, we still haven't seen anything from it.
The last thing we saw of it was like the logo of like Dragon Age Dreadwolf, right?
Yes, the logo. It's called Dragon Age Dreadwolf. There have been a couple of leaked screenshots.
Right,
but leaked footage. There was nothing official yet. There's been some rumors that it's going to be showing up this summer at these Naughty 3 events. But yeah, so that's one of the games on EA's docket for this year. And the other game is a partner title. Which partner title is like, is that Hazelight? Or is that, you know, some other, you know, smaller developer that they're, you know, putting under like the EA Originals label or whatever? I'm not sure. But they're calling it a partner title.
All I remember from this presentation, when we were talking about, like, I guess the EA CEO was talking about their next Battlefield game in development.
Yes.
Calling it either the biggest or the most like live service game ever.
It's going to be a great live service. Yeah, like, that's what people speak about these.
That's what I love to hear about, you know, the first thing about know about a game that in development.
I also think in the investor call, I saw some stuff about he mused on putting advertisements in games. Like, in-game ads.
It's definitely been here and there in terms of like, you know, when you're putting like a real ads in like, say, like a racing
game,
like an F1 game, like billboard or whatever. But if it's like intrusive, like it's like in your face that you have to like skip through it, then that's gonna be really annoying. If it's like as part of the world, as like a billboard, fine, you know. But if it's gonna be anything more than that, that's intrusive. That's no good.
Anyways, two other companies to talk about. Capcom. Capcom is basically out of all the Japanese publishers, they're on top right now. Like, let me pull it up here. They're on 11 consecutive years of operating income growth. They're on 7 consecutive years of record high profits. They're planning on getting to 12 and 8 respectively next year in both of those categories. They have sales numbers for all of their games. Let me see here. Resident Evil 4 Remake sold another 3 million units this year. It's up to 7 million units. Street Fighter 6 is at 3 million units. Monster Hunter World sold another 3 million units, so it's up to 25 million units. Dragon's Dogma 2 is at 2.5 million. So they have a lot of games.
Can I just say, so this was just from this quarter or from the last year?
Fiscal year. Whole year.
Fiscal year. Yeah. Still, how old is Monster Hunter World now, and it sold 3 million extra copies this year?
Is that because after the Monster Hunter
Return
World
to
announcements,
world.
They're like, hey,
yeah, Return to World,
play.
Yeah.
You guys should play World. People did.
Three million new players were like, yeah, you know what? I will.
And Sunbreak sold another 2 million units. It's up to 7 million or 7.7 million. And then also even some smaller titles like Mega Man Battle Network combined, because remember it was sold in like two groups, is at 1.6 million. Like, that's pretty good for a Battle Network.
Especially for like, you know, like kind of like a retro collection title.
Yeah.
Didn't one of the Ace Attorney collections also sell decent amount,
1.2 million. Yeah.
Wow. Jesus.
Damn, imagine thinking that they didn't want to bring the series over here because they think it wouldn't sell. Imagine that.
So it's Capcom is just doing really, really well. I remember you mentioned Adam, that like they had a really, really cool section about like ensuring their employees' well-being during their support as well.
I'll get to that in just a second.
Okay.
But Capcom's basically forecast for this next year, like I said, they're aiming for record profits and income growth again. And for now, they're focusing on like a couple of, I would say, sort of smaller titles, in that they have the Monster Hunter Stories remaster plus Monster Hunter Stories 2 port. So those are coming out this summer. Then they have Kanutsugami Path of the Goddess, which is sort of, that's interesting because it's like a new IP. And it's also, it's not really like in a well-defined genre. I don't know if you guys have looked at some of the like the gameplay footage of it, but it's, I think James actually put it this way. It's sort of like tower defense plus Pikmin in with action combat.
I mentioned that, like, I imagine it's like this extremely challenging to like sell to people because it's so, like you said, not well defined. It's like if people are gonna ask, is this like DMC? Is this like Monster Hunter? Is this like, you know, insert Capcom game here? It's like kinda, sorta, but that'd be kind of the response you'd give to that question.
I'd imagine that it's probably going to be successful for them regardless, because this is on Game Pass, so they probably got enough money to pay for the development from Microsoft before they started falling apart.
Yeah.
And so, also, the other game they're cool highlighting is not really a game, but they're highlighting basically continual content for Street Fighter VI.
Yeah. This is, from what I understand, their seventh consecutive year of record-breaking profits in a row, from what people were saying.
Yep, nope, I said that.
Yeah, and they're like targeting for it to be even higher next year, which, if the rumors that both Resident Evil 9 and Monster Hunter Wilds are releasing before the end of the fiscal year, that's just going to happen.
You didn't mention this, but also, like, with this past fiscal year, that Dragon's Dogma Dark Arisen sold 1.5 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dragon's Dogma, the original, just sold a cool million and a half.
Yeah.
Granted, those are probably at like $15 or less or whatever, but still.
Yeah, no, but still, it's still a lot of copies going around. Just
hey, I was one of them. No, I think I was actually. Yeah, I was one of them.
Yeah, there's definitely a good chunk of people that like, hey, I want to like know what Dragon's Dogma is. Going into two, and then picked it up.
But yeah, so you asked about these fiscal reports. Then they don't only just report on like sales and revenue, but they also just like initiatives at like the company, including things like salary and diversity and employee leave and things like that. And Capcom specifically, one thing that they really focused on was like childcare leave for employees. Having like literally in their document, if I can pull it up here, like making sure they promote it so that employees are aware of it and that employees use it when they are, you know, when they're able to. And so they're also interested in things like salaries. In the last couple of years, a lot of Japanese game salaries have gone up because they were kind of stagnant for a while. And then, you know how it is, like one company pushes their salaries up and then everyone else kind of has to follow because they want to compete, right? So, they brought up, they're talking about salaries, they're talking about leave, they want more women in managerial positions. And all of these things I just said are also true for Sega. Sega also highlighted like the need for diversity and having more women managers. Not so much focus on like childcare leave, but talking about, you know, employee well-being in general. So a lot of these discuss these things.
Yeah, it goes into like the broader conversation of like talent retention. You know, when you kind of contrast this with, like, some of the like news bits of say the Microsoft developments earlier this week. You know, like the importance of retaining your talent, making sure that, you know, they feel like they have a sense of job security, essentially, that their jobs will at least be able to like accommodate their needs to some extent, you know, when life, you know, happens to them.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously a very, very important thing of just like workplace culture in general. It should be like, you know, like a standard practice, institutionalized as well. So I'm really glad that like that they noted this in their fiscal report, calling attention to it, that like, you know, we try our best, you know, to just make sure that our employees know that they have these options available to them when they need to use them.
And a lot of these super reports also have sections on like environment. So not like human resources, but literally the environment in which we live. And Sega is talking about like improving their suppliers, emission reductions, reduction targets that they're applying. They're hoping to get reduction of carbon. They just call it carbon emission by 50% in the next 6 years. So things like that too. All these things are considered in these reports.
In general, Capcom and Sega are doing pretty well, all things considered.
Lastly, we have a new Onimusha.
What? So they did like a Switch remaster of one, right? And then
I think they just don't want to like deal with like all that music copyright jumbo because of the old composer causing all this conflict with it. I think that's why we haven't even seen like a remaster of 2 and stuff.
Just like, I wonder what their goals were with that re-release of what, like, if they had like any sort of like future plans, like are they gonna at least remake some part of Onimusha again? I remember when they first showed Kenichigami for the first time, like everyone's a good portion of people were like, oh, is this a new Onimusha?
You know, when they first saw it. I thought the same thing too. Yeah. I was like, but no.
Because it looked like, you know, because Dawn of Dreams definitely had that aesthetic, you know, like more of like ancient Japan, sort of like more traditional sort of style. So
I have one question for you. If they make a new Onimusha game, who do you want the protagonist to be portrayed by? They always get like a real life big celebrity to portray the main character of some sort.
Who did Shogun, that show? I forgot the celebrity's name. Was it Hiroyuki something?
Sonata?
Famous samurai.
I know who you're talking about. He's the main villain of Rush Hour 3. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. But I forgot the celebrity's name from Shogun. But he seems to be the one most popular right now. And that says so. I think that would be a natural fit if they were to get a big celebrity portrayed.
Wait, I was right.
Was it Sonata? Really? Oh yeah. Okay.
Damn. You were thinking that
it was Hiroyuki Sanada.
Yeah, that would be good.
Anyways, the last company with a fiscal report that I think is something we can have anything to say about is Bandai Namco. And long story short, sales are up. The profit is actually down pretty significantly this year. And the reason for that is that they basically all but confirmed that Bandai Namco, similar to Square Enix, also canceled some games. They didn't call it an extraordinary loss in this case. They're just putting it in their like entertainment segment, their loss, so it's not extraordinary in their framing of it. But they basically mention revising their lineup or reevaluating their lineup, and they call it disposal losses. So it seems like Bandai Namco similarly probably had some stuff in the pipeline that they just decided, you know what, we need to focus a little bit more, or, you know, cut out some things that maybe they're not super confident in or what have you.
Didn't they publicly say that they were going to do that, like similar to like Square Enix are trying to focus on fewer but like higher quality projects?
They've said as much in their most recent. So the fiscal report for the fourth quarter actually hasn't been like fully translated yet. But the previous quarter, they said this also. Let me copy this image here. I highlighted the parts where you can clearly see the effect. Basically their profits in the second half of this year are actually negative in the entertainment section, basically because they're taking these losses. And then the other component to that is they keep mentioning a valuation loss from a online title, which they refuse to say by name.
But that will not be named.
But it's most likely Blue Protocol. Seemingly not doing very well. So
I haven't been paying too close attention, but I do know from what I've heard from people that have played the Japanese release that a lot of what I was personally interested in from testing it, like trying it out at last Summer Game Fest, a lot of that was just like axed from the full release. Like a lot of the like kind of open world, like less theme park stuff was just kind of axed. So yeah, I definitely maybe it's different now, maybe it's changed, but I remember hearing something along those lines closer to launch, and that would explain why maybe it hasn't been as well received.
Yeah, I also heard, like, you know, there's we're all working off of, like, outdated info because we don't know what the state of the game is, like, at this moment, but, like, from what I heard from, like, friends who played it or other people who've been playing it, that, like, just, like, the end game loop activities are just, like, not interesting at all, just not well thought out. Which you know, factors into it as well. When you're thinking about the lifetime of, like, an MMO, you'd want to have interesting, like, high level end game activities to keep on coming back to it.
I have a question with this Bandai Namco thing. Does this, like, count from, like, separate IPs, like maybe, like, you know, Gundam?
Oh, I was actually about to mention, I don't have it in front of me here, but Bandai Namco actually does a lot of the reporting by IP. Like, quite literally, they don't. So, like, when they report on Gundam, they, like, are combining ticket sales, merch sales, game sales, and everything kind of all in the one bucket. At least that's the way I understand it. And actually, I believe Gundam had the best year ever as far as Bandai Namco is concerned.
It's always the best year ever.
Always the best year.
But like you mentioned earlier before the podcast, a lot of that's attributed to The Witch from Mercury. They're, like, you know, this whole TV run and the worldwide success of that, and also with the Gundam Seed movie coming out, all the marketing, merchandising, and obviously it's the stellar success that it had in Japan when it aired there in theaters. Chao and I went to go see it when it aired in our places.
Damn, you know the people in front of me, they were playing like four different Gundam gacha games in front of me.
Are you? That's funny. I saw,
and then he was asking me, he's like, "Have you played Stellar Blade? Like, what do you think?" Wait, what?
they asked you if you played Stellar Blade randomly?
Yeah, because that guy was like talking on the phone. It's like, "Hey guys, I am right by Stellar Blade," and he's like, "Have you played it?" They're like, "Yeah."
So they just asked around. He was like, "Hey, have you played Stellar Blade?"
Yeah, basically.
That's awesome.
They were talking about, it's like, what were we expecting from this Gundam movie? Is there going to be a mass dude that's going to save the day? You know, they always ask for a Gundam trope. It's like, they had like a checklist. I forgot what the checklist was. And they were
so,
like,
just to correct myself, they separate it into, like, sales of IP and sales of IP toys and hobby. So there's, like, two different groupings, I guess, but they're still ordered by, like, the franchises that they track are, I don't even know what this is. Anpan Man, Ultraman, Kamen Rider,
that's
Gundam, Super
Man.
Sentai. Yeah, I don't know what Anpan Man is.
It's a popular kid show.
Like a kid show? Okay, Dragon Ball, Naruto, Pretty Cure, and One Piece. So,
let's go Pretty Cure!
Oh, I guess they also have, I guess Pokemon toys also are attributed to Bandai. So,
oh, okay.
Because they have Pokemon there. Okay. Next time you buy a Pokemon toy, you can think to yourself, I am supporting Bandai Namco.
Yeah, I'm gonna say this is made by Bandai Namco.
You sure about that?
Hey, they have it literally in their report here. So, but yeah, what's actually sort of funny as far as video games go is it's kind of funny when you just say it out loud. But for next year, they're expecting, in terms of profit percentage increase in video games compared to this year, they're expecting a nearly 500% increase in profits. What? So it's like, thank you, Elden Ring DLC, is my guess. So,
I was expecting Elden Ring 2 at this point. You want
an
increase?
Well, I think it's that, as well as the other games that they're highlighting strongly are Dragon Ball Sparking Zero, Budokai, whatever that game is called. That one, they're highlighting that one a lot. So I think they expect that one to do well. So, oh, they also do have a. They don't really say much about it other than listing it, but they do have Gundam Breaker 4 on here as a game, as a major
hell
title.
Hell yeah, we'll talk about that later, but I'm excited. It better light the world on fire, it better sell like 10 gigajillion copies. That's a real number.
The only other, Marvelous had their report also, it's not translated yet, other than the basics. They basically said they have a couple of unannounced games that they're going to be announcing. Which,
more Rune Factory.
The thing is that they've already announced a few Rune Factories, and I'm not sure where those are. Are those possibly the games they're not disclosing yet?
They have like a new mainline Rune Factory, then they have a spinoff that's like more like ancient Japan theme.
Yeah,
I think.
I forget what it's called. They had a live stream that went over all of this. And then they announced a few other games whose names I forget. There was one that had like the fairy tale artist on it. I completely blanked what that game was.
Me too. Wow.
Yeah. And there's one I think they called like literally Project RPG or something. One second. I feel dumb. Like I'm being very vague. Sorry, I
have what if it's called Project RPG and it's not an RPG? Or maybe it's just like it's RPG because there's a rocket.
Oh, Project. Okay, I found it here. This is from last May, so about a year ago. They announced Project Life is RPG.
Oh.
It's literally called Project Life is RPG. And then they announced Project Magia, which that's the one I was thinking of with the fairy tale art. And then they announced, they also announced a new Daemon X Machina. Daemon X Machina.
Oh, yeah. That's
Daemon Cross Machina, whatever you call that.
Wherever so, that is.
Yeah. So they have a few of these games that are announced. Their report this year mentioned like unannounced games. I don't know if it's actually unannounced or if it's one of those games that was previously announced, but they just aren't revealing it yet. I'm not sure, but Marvelous basically says they have some stuff planned. So, so it's Rune Factory 6 and Rune Factory Project Dragon are the two Rune Factory games, also from last May. So that's it.
All right. I think, I was still looking at the Bandai Namco stuff. I was like, did they mention Tekken at all?
Oh, they do mention Tekken.
Okay.
Unfortunately, Bandai Namco works is that they release like in English a consolidated report, which basically it's translated, but it's basically just like the numbers. Later, like some of these other companies like Capcom, we have fully translated slides and everything that we can get a lot more from. Bandai Namco will eventually give us that, but not yet. So it's all in Japanese for now. So I
guess the major one that we're still waiting for, I assume it's going to come sometime this week, is Square Enix, right?
That should be Sunday night. So if you're listening to this podcast on Sunday or on Monday, you might already know about some of this. So
right. The D-Day is upon us.
Square Enix will be interesting because they're literally going through all of this reformation about, you know, the organization. They're going to probably be public on some of that. They have to go over their sales results and like, did they hit their expectations or not? And quite literally, they said previously, our goal this year, our results this year, basically hinge on how well Final Fantasy VII Rebirth does. So we'll see if that worked out or not. And I don't know if they'll give hard numbers, if they'll just say it hit a target or not, but we'll get something.
It hit a target.
They have literally a revenue target.
I know, but that'd be funny if that's not the exact verbiage. It's like, well, it hit a target. Like, are you gonna tell us? No, it hit a target.
You know, what their goals are for this fiscal year that we're currently in. This fiscal year is interesting because it's like last year they had two AAA games in Final Fantasy 16 and Rebirth. It's like this year, as far as we know, I'm talking about HD games, not MMOs. They have Dawn Trail, but that's a different category, like literally separate category. It's like, what is their biggest game this year? Is it literally like Visions of Mana? As far as we know, it seems like
it. Because Saga already released. So
I would say Mana would be bigger than Saga.
Adam said Dawn Trail's in a separate category.
Yeah, because they separate HD games and MMOs. So I meant like literally.
So
in the
of the games that are announced, then would have to be Visions of Mana.
Yeah,
we'll see what else is.
Mana has to Mana carry Square Enix like always, you know.
Yep.
Were there any other fiscal reports that you wanted to mention here, Adam?
I think those are the only ones I could think of.
Okay. Yeah.
I think there were other small ones like Clopal, which we'll talk about.
Right.
Which I don't really look into because that's more Japanese focused.
Right. So. Moving on to the news this week, aside from the industry and fiscal news that we covered, just not too much, but still meaty enough. Like you mentioned earlier, Hades 2 entered early access this week on Steam and Epic Game Store. It's available now on there, and I believe it's at a relatively low price. It's about $30. Yes, $30. Supergiant Games has mentioned that even in this early access state of Hades 2, they say it has more environments, foes, and fully voiced characters than the full version of the first Hades game. It is quite a bit. So yes, you're getting a very, very, very big game already out of the gate, and they're planning on adding more stuff to that game. They expect that the early access period for Hades 2 will last through the end of 2024. They don't have a specific end date in mind for Hades 2 at the moment. And just be aware that this $30 US dollars price point at the moment can be raised at a later point depending on the scope and of the additional content that they add to Hades 2 over time. So just be aware that that $30 US dollars price point might not last forever depending on the scope of what they add to it down the line. But people are already loving that game right out of the gate. Very, very strong title. I do want to pick it up. I just don't know if I want to pick it up right now or maybe full game. It's that the early access conundrum. It has to be, you know, very fully featured. Atlas dropped another press packet for Metaphor ReFantazio. It basically expands on like all the things that they showed off at the release date announcement live stream. They call the battle system of this game Fast and Squad. Fast being like the action RPG element of the game, and Squad is more of like the command battle turn-based aspect of it. So that is the name of the battle system in Metaphor ReFantazio, Fast and Squad. They mentioned throughout this press packet that the average difficulty of Metaphor ReFantazio is intentionally made to be high. I don't know how this will manifest in the game. I'm hoping that means just a more challenging RPG overall on like the normal difficulty, and hopefully there'll be like an easier difficulty for people who want to, you know, just, you know, have an easier time of the game, obviously. But I'm hoping like even just the normal difficulty just is a challenging difficulty over like stuff like Persona 5 Royal and Persona 3 Reload, which are quite frankly like cakewalks on their default difficulties. But they try to stress this by having like just having this whole prep phase before you go tackle the dungeon. So like whether you want more, you're purchasing more information about the dungeon that you're traveling to, ranking up, you know, yeah, sort of like your party, their equipment, and then like this whole archetype job system that you gain by getting new followers, and even like the archetype tree, that like just there's like this screenshot that shows the archetype tree, and like they show off like 5 to 6 of the archetypes out of like easily over like a dozen or so jobs. So they're kind of leading towards that, like, hey, this game will have a lot of jobs to choose from, and you can kind of mix and match like your party composition and their capability based off of that. Just showing off more of like how the quests and the towns are in this game, so forth. So once again, that game is coming out on October 11th worldwide simultaneously for both PlayStation platforms, Xbox Series, and PC via Steam. So just give that a look if you're interested in learning more about Metaphor ReFantazio. Atlas also put out a bunch of information for Shin Megami Tensei 5 Vengeance, which is releasing next month on June 14th. So it is almost exactly a month away. The first up, they released a new press packet. They showed off 3 new demons that are making their debut into the SMT series. They all come from African mythology. It is on Yankopon, Anansi, and Nyami Nyami, all designed by Doi. All look very cool. They also show off a little bit more of the new dungeon, Shakan. They showed off that since this Return of the True Demon subquest was originally a DLC for the original base SMT5 release, obviously there's going to be part of the main game for Vengeance now. And at some point, when you meet some certain conditions, the Demi-Fiend from the SMT3 Nocturne, who was the protagonist of that, can join your party in this game.
So I gather that they've shown a lot of like different characters that can be like guest characters in your party, like the other human characters in the game. But it seems like that is all on the Vengeance route, from mm-hmm. what I'm understanding. So I'm not sure if like the normal route or the original route, which, what are they calling it? Creation. That's it. That route will be more or less the same as it was before in terms of like you're just some parties of demons. Obviously, it's going to have a bunch of updates that are global, but I'm not entirely sure if you'll be able to like recruit characters like Demi-Fiend and other humans as guests on that route. They might be separate.
Yeah, that's true. Yes.
I'll get it when they add the Dante DLC.
Where's Raido?
I know, right? They're also adding a new feature called the Virtual Trainer. So for people who really, really want like challenging battles, who really thrive off like very, very challenging turn-based battles. This is interesting in the way that it's being structured. So this is basically, it's located in the Diet Building. And it's between like, there's this original mode and challenge mode. And this lets you refight like key encounters throughout the story. And challenge mode is each time the game is cleared, all the levels of the enemies in the challenge mode virtual trainer is increased by 100 every time you beat the game. Which is interesting. And this goes up to level 999. Huh. Which is, I'm sure there should be like crazy clear videos on YouTube like, hey, I beat level 999, I don't know, this boss fight, you know? Okay, what the fuck did you use? So it's definitely for those people who really, really want to challenge themselves of like creating like custom party compositions to beat like a certain high level boss. This game allows you to break the level limit to up to level 150 through a new miracle. So you can have super, super powered demons as well. And they showed off, they detailed some of the new game plus features of like what you can carry over on certain new game plus ways. There's like newborn, reborn, and godborn. Godborn is kind of like that new game plus, but it raises every enemy in the game up to level 150. So if you really want a challenge, a very, very challenging new game plus, but like you get to basically challenge your like new souped up party of demons, you can go through Godborn and have every enemy be a fucking threat to you. On top of that, later that day, Atlas also had a SMT5 Vengeance complete guide stream, which, you know, details a lot of like what we know about the game already along with that press packet. And they listed like 50 like unique features and adjustments to this game. Some of them is just nice, like, you know, like aerial enemies won't attack you off screen out of nowhere and just jump scare you, which happened a lot more than you think in the original base game.
Yeah, I forget what those demons are called, but in the the first like area, there's a ton of them.
Yeah, or did like some of like polishing up like the color coding of like map elevation, so it's like easier to see which elevation of the map that you're on, and a lot of like the complete guide aside from that, like really focused on this system where there's like unique attacks, Magatsuhi skills that demons can do when certain demon formations are like available to you in your party. So like there's like this Greek demon lineup like Orthrus, Cerberus, Chimera, and I think Orochi, I believe, like did this like combination attack of like fire, like they all speed fire. He had like the support skill that like Pixie the High Pixie did. He had like this cat centric skill or Magatsuhi skill or attack that had like Neko Shogun, Ketchi, and
Hate-Zip.
I forgot the name. Yes. Right. Yeah. And Nekomata. Yeah. And then they also, you know, provided like a sort of like an example lineup of like Feng Huang, Surt, and Moloch, and like show you like, hey, you can do like a super powered like fire attack to demons that are weak to fire, and like stressing like party composition is like very important if you want to really specialize in certain like do certain attack patterns. One of the interesting ones that I saw on this is like Norn has like this special unique skill that like when you switch out demons, it won't consume a press turn icon.
I mean that kind of makes sense canonically. Norn is a time lord.
Yeah, and then there'll be some unique skills for demons that like they activate when they're switched out into the main party. So, like, you know, there could be a potential like interesting like party composition or strat that you can do, like let's like that has Norn in your party, basically activate unique demon skills for free because they are upon activation, one of the activation triggers is, hey, I'm now in the party because I was swapped out. That might do something to your party. So that's, that, you know, just basically like expands your ways of like tackling combat and like your strategies. And so that's really cool to see them like kind of hone in and focus on that, you know, that part of the video, like stressing that like, hey, party composition going to be very important in this title. And we're going to reward you for really thinking about your party composition. Which is,
I mean, that's generally sure. Something you like to see in all SMT games, yeah, you know, since it's so darn flexible. So
yeah, that's cool.
You generally want to have some thought. I mean, the original game was pretty good at that too, but it seems like they're adding more, you know, things to experiment with, all the different combos that you can do.
Yeah.
So
good on them. This game looks too.
It feels like a brand new game.
It does.
I mean, we'll see, but it's like they're adding a lot, tweaking a lot.
Way more than we originally expected. And this is like when this is first, that's like, oh, it's just like, you know, they're
updating. Just like the strange journey thing where it's like, oh, okay, there's a little bit of an extra whatever.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's like, no, it seems pretty more significant than that.
So. Yeah. So good to see. Summerfall Studios and Humble Games have announced a brand new story DLC for Stray Gods, the role-playing musical with Stray Gods Orpheus. That is launching on June 27th for PC and will be coming to consoles later. This focuses on Orpheus, who is now brought back to the world of living by Hermes. And then, so the protagonist of this one is Orpheus, and players will be guiding him on like which instrument to play, who he's going to date, what goals to strive for, etc. And of course, you know, being a role-playing musical, one of the key-centric things in the game is having songs. So there'll be 6 new songs coming to this DLC, and depending on the decisions made by players, it depends. It changes not only the story, but which of these songs are going to be played in this DLC. And then the developer and publisher describes this DLC as a comedic feature-length experience that history buffs, hopeless romantics, and rock stars alike can enjoy. We have a teaser trailer and screenshots for that DLC up on the site. Furthermore, Don't Nod and Focus Entertainment have released a free demo for Banisher's Ghosts of New Eden, which originally released early in February. Do you have any sense of like what the scope of this demo is, Adam?
There is a section in the game early on that is basically like it's pretty cleanly delineated as like the prologue. So my guess is that's the demo. It kind of gives you like a taste of like the combat and the investigative sections of the game, kind of gives you a taste of all of those mechanics before it kind of actually puts you in like the actual world of the game. So that's my guess, is that's what the demo would be. So yeah, okay. This game came out a couple months ago. I was sort of mixed on it. I think it had some really strong points, but a couple of weak spots as well. And, you know, like I think I said this earlier, even if a demo comes out after the game is released, why not? I think it's a good idea. So
yeah. It just gives people, like, you know, like a way to, like, see if the game is for them without, like, having to, like, spend any money to see if, like, if it's for them.
Right.
Always a win-win. As Destiny 2 is coming up on its next big expansion with the Final Shape, which is launching on June 4th. Bungie is giving away for players to experience the story beforehand. So Destiny 2 Shadowkeep, Beyond Light, and the Witch Queen, those expansions are all free for all players until June 3rd. So these are there's a temporary thing. There's not a permanent, hey, these are all free. Moving forward, though, these are only free until June 3rd. So if you want to get caught up with the story and haven't bought Shadowkeep, Beyond Light, or Witch Queen, they are all free for a limited time until June 3rd. And then a day later, the Final Shape is launching on June 4th. So, you know, in addition to campaigns and the story beats, expansion exclusive activities will be available to players during this open access period. So this will be like, you know, include quests for exotic weapons, and any other expansion raids that these three expansions offered when they were put up on sale.
Yeah, it's good that they're doing this to try and entice people to start playing the game, because the thing that you need to understand about this is that also, like, technically Destiny 2 is free to play. Which isn't actually true, because there are stipulations, but letting people play through all these campaigns in the prep for Final Shape is pretty good. Also notable is that I believe Lightfall is actually one of the PlayStation Plus titles this month.
Okay.
So if you have PlayStation Plus, that means you basically have access to everything that's still in the game. Except for maybe some of the content from Forsaken that's still in there. But I think that might be the, like, one kind of exception.
And Final Shape is going to be like you kind of need the story knowledge from, like, these previous experiences to really make the Final Shape's events make sense.
One of the main problems that Destiny 2 has had for a while, and kind of one of the reasons why it's really, really hard for new players to get into it, is that ever since Shadowkeep, or I guess even more so, ever since, like, Shadowkeep, they've done a thing where it's like, okay, we are shuttering there's seasons, and you know how, like, for games as a service, there'll be seasons that have content and whatnot. Their story is attached to those seasons. And the way it works is that until the Final Shape comes out, you can access any of the seasons, any of the story attached to them for Lightfall if you play the game, like, right now. But as soon as the Final Shape hits, while the base game content and any of, like, the exotic missions that were added to the base game are still available or will still be available, any of the stuff that was added as seasonal content is going to be gone. And that applies to every single one of the expansions, like Beyond Light. Any of the seasonal stuff no longer in there. Witch Queen, any of the seasonal stuff no longer in there. And there's a lot of story stuff that's very important that happens in those seasons. And in fact, one of the main complaints people had with Lightfall is it was a filler expansion. It was very clear that, like, people even, like, took a look at the opening cutscene and the ending cutscene, and if you, like, splice them together, you would have thought they were just one single cutscene. So a lot of people assumed, because originally Lightfall was going to be the last expansion, then later on they announced, oh no, there's going to be the Final Shape instead. So a lot of people assume that originally it was just going to be Lightfall. It takes place in between what would have been the opening cutscene to the Final Shape. So a lot of seasonal stuff is actually the important, like, context and story stuff for Destiny 2. And
so hopefully there's a YouTube video that recaps everything nicely and neatly then.
Well, there definitely is. There's Destiny YouTubers that are very into the lore. Like, my name is Biff, I think, is the main one that people talk about. But it's like, I will probably play this. When does Final Shape come out again? It's June 4th, right?
June 4th.
June 4th. Okay, so I'll probably play that, but I don't know if I'll request code. I might just write up something about it, but also, like, it's right around Summer Games Fest, which Adam and I are both going to be at, so we're going to be busy and whatnot. So, and to be blunt, and I've said this before, ever since, like, the massive layoffs at Bungie that were very clearly management trying to save their skin so Sony doesn't take control, like, of management, I don't feel really good, like, directly supporting Destiny when so many of the people that put their, like, blood, sweat, and tears into making the game as good as it can be are no longer at the company due to no fault of their own.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. And I know that I'm not the only one that feels that way. You see a lot of Destiny players that feel the same.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, if you're giving Destiny 2, if this is your way to getting into Destiny 2 the first time, Godspeed on, like, making sense of anything and what you have to do to get ready for the Final Shape. It feels like still one of the ongoing things about one of the ongoing problems about that game is, like, hey, I want to get into Destiny 2. What do? When I boot up the game? Well,
here's a YouTube playlist. Go nuts.
You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but you know we don't really go to like follow Colopol that much as far as their fiscal stuff. But you know they on their latest financial results, Colopol mentioned that following up on the news that Kazuma Kaneko leaving Atlas for Colopol last week or maybe the week before that, they announced that Kazuma Kaneko is now working on a new game for them called Project Mask. At the moment, the main visual for this is a dude that sorta looks like a Raido from Devil Summoner, wearing a mask and like gloves, so and you know a cape. And the theme is creating a new game experience with God. This is sure, why not? We probably will not get this game in the West, but you know, it's kind of like a follow up, like hey, they're putting Kazuma Kaneko under a new project, and that's what the project is called. And the dude, the main visual for it, kind of looks like Raido in a wearing a mask. So that is what Kaneko is up to over there. Moving on to release dates.
But really quick, I was just looking up like Colopol. They do have an English website. Like, what games? Like, do I recognize any of these games? I actually do recognize one barely. They have like a lot of mobile games. One of them is called Volzerk Monsters and Lands Unknown, which is that's the one that I've heard of. and by heard of, I mean like I think I saw it in an email once. And like I don't know some of these other games: Neko Golf, Anime Golf. I never heard of Shiro Neko the Alarm. Isn't that a show? I don't know. Alice Gear.
I've heard Alice Gear before. I don't know if that ever got released in the West.
Shiro like Neko Tennis. Series. Meow Meow Star Acres.
Oh, yeah. I heard of Shiro Neko Project. Fun Daily Life of
Cats on Star Island. Quiz RPG. Yeah.
That's kind of weird, right? They have they have an English-facing website for this, but I think a lot of these are not released in the West.
Like, yeah. I don't know.
So, I don't know.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, I was basically wondering, like, do I know anything that these people have made? And not really.
Not really.
Yeah.
Moving on to dates, we have Questmaster that launches in Steam Early Access on May 29th by developers Sky Devil Palm and published by Apogee Entertainment. And they also have an Early Access roadmap as well on this. What is this, Adam? What kind of a game is
First of
this?
All, it's just sort of heartwarming to me to see Apogee as like a publisher again. Sorry, I grew up in the DOS days, so Apogee means a lot to me. But anyways, this is like it looks like a 2D Zelda game with that sort of pixel style. And it's largely like a dungeon creator. Like if you like dungeons and Zelda games, it allows you to create those. I gather that like once it's out of early access, they're gonna have like its own like bespoke story and narrative and whatnot in the game. But as I understand it, it seems like the early access release is mostly like the dungeon creator stuff. So
okay,
that seems to be the main hook of it.
Okay, that's cool. And then when it launches in early access in May, it'll have like multiplayer co-op, online.
Yeah, there's a multiplayer component too. Yeah.
Yeah. So it seems like the early access period of it is largely focused on that editing and like kind of not just creating dungeons but also sharing them and publishing them to the community and getting feedback for that. So it seems to be creator focused, which is cool. And then they're aiming for the full 1.0 release in Q4 of this year, and that'll have the single player story mode with side quests, so it'll have that more traditional structure format. And so forth. Launching on June 6th, shortly after the release of Destiny 2, The Final Shape, a huge, huge competitor here, the gaming van is releasing Legends of Dionysus. This is the action RPG that I reported on several weeks ago. And this is what the developer said. This was developed by a solo developer in a van. A demo for the game is available on Steam and itch.io. And largely that's all that is. It's just like, hey, we're announcing the release date on June 6th.
And he literally named his development, like his developer name, as the gaming van. So
yeah. He's developing it on the go. They're hustling. They're grinding. Coming on June 13th, we have the final Pathfinder Rite of the Righteous, Wrath of the Righteous DLC, A Dance of Mass. This is the sixth and final DLC. Long time coming, and this will be launching on June 13th for all platforms. So that'll be on PlayStation, Xbox, PC, and Switch. This will add new story content, new personal events for every companion, new romantic event for every romanceable companion. They also get access to an arena for challenging fights, and 11 new character archetypes.
I know Brian, he reviewed the original game, and kind of like with the original Pathfinder Kingmaker, it was like not as buggy, but still like sort of rough at launch. And he was planning on getting to these DLCs, but he was just waiting for them all to release first before touching any of them. So
when was the original release of this game?
2021. So okay. Almost 3 years.
At long last, Brian can finally embark on his Pathfinder playthrough.
Yeah, I think he pretty much said he's just going to start a new game at this point. Yeah. Like it's been changed and updated so much. So,
yeah, the right call. Another news here. Gestalt, Steam, and Cinder. The release date, PC release date, has been delayed to July 16th. It was originally slated to arrive later this month on May 21st, but they moved that back because the development team has spotted some unforeseen issues during their last round of testing, and they wanted to address them before launch. You know, they want to deliver like the very best version of this game, but have the first impression of this game be very positive and make sure that it's all polished up before release. Understandable. They have yet to acknowledge if this game is coming to other platforms, because originally when this game was announced several years ago. It was supposed to come out on PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and Switch. But ever since, they've come back out and, announced the release date and so forth, they've only acknowledged the PC version of this game. So we don't know the status of those other releases as of this moment. And
it is a little bit of a bummer after literally years of silence. They finally give a release date of May, and then, almost immediately are like, actually, never mind. July.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want to repeat an AU, then have a critical bug that prevent you from getting the main true ending or something.
Yeah.
But yeah. It's, I'm still really interested in this. It looks cool.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I just,
at the very least, at the very least, it's got a good, aesthetic and art style color palette. So,
yeah. I'll be interested in just checking it out, but I'm not going to review it. I want to play the game at my own pace. So,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, child, not that you expressed interest, you have to review it, no matter what. It's over for
you. Well, now it's releasing almost the same day as Dungeons of Hinterberg, and so I think Junior can't review both. Well, he probably could, but...
Look, it's delayed to, Dawn Trail.
Oh, yeah, that is going to be just a few weeks after Dawn Trail, so...
It's oh my god.
I should probably put my name up on the review doc for some of these things, because I've been working on other stuff as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like Sandland.
Well, good thing this next game you have no interest in.
Yep, exactly. Definitely not going to be reviewing this for sure. Gundam Breaker 4 announced a release date. They are releasing worldwide simultaneously on August 29th. The English version of this trailer is very funny because it's a very, very excited narrator telling you about the features of this game. They showed off five new units that'll be joining the roster. The first two are from Witch from Mercury with the Gundam Ariel. People love that unit. And the Daryl Bald, which is one of the antagonist units from Witch from Mercury. Interestingly enough, they're also adding the Gundam Helios, and that is from the Gundam Breaker Battlelog OVA series, which wasn't really that popular. But a lot of the new units coming to this game is from Gundam Breaker Battlelog, interestingly enough. So that seems to have, that's the series that has, the most new unit representation coming into this.
Does it have the Freedom movie units?
They may come as DLC. They might announce that as DLC. I imagine they'll add those units as DLC. Definitely Rising Freedom.
They're jobber units, guys. That's a spoiler here. They're jobber units. They're not OP.
Dude,
I still find it interesting that this game is going to be English dubbed also.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's true.
I know a lot of the more recent stuff gets dubbed, but like, I wonder how the older stuff's going to be handled. Some of it was never dubbed, and some of it, you know, probably don't have access to those voice actors anymore.
My favorite one is the Gundam Seed movie. I think people on Reddit watched it dubbed, and they pronounced like Lacus in this new dub is like Lacus, and they were so annoyed. They were so annoyed by it, they demanded a refund.
No way! They pronounced as Lacus. That's crazy.
Yeah, they were so mad about it, and they wanted like a refund. Like, immediately.
Oh my god, that's funny as fuck. I never would have like expected them to. I thought they would just like call it Lacus because that's how the previous English dub.
Yeah, that's what people Lacus. Everyone was expecting, and they're like, it's Lacus now. I'm like, what?
That's I don't know. That's incredible. So I imagine Gundam Seed movie units will eventually come as DLC. That hasn't been confirmed or officially announced. I just imagine that's like what they'll do.
I mean, have they announced like Wish for Mercury units yet?
They did for the Gundam Ariel and Daryl Bald in this trailer.
Okay. I imagine they're going to try to like ride high on that popularity. Like, hey, the show, buy this game. So
I imagine also they'll add new Wish for Mercury units through DLC. Yeah. I imagine, you know, they might get the Feract and like the Calabar maybe as the DLC as well. So that's my guess. That's what makes sense because those are popular. They also announced the Kasi Gundam from Hathaway's Flash. Obviously, that's also popular at the moment as well with the Hathaway's Flash movie. But because of COVID, that pushed back the development schedule of the next Hathaway's Flash movies to an indefinite date. So hopefully they'll come. The Hathaway's Flash movie was really, really good. A lot of people liked it. And then they also, one of the more amusing ones that they announced here is they're adding the RX-93FF New Gundam. So there's an interesting lineage because, you know, those life-size Gundam statues that they're making over in Japan, like, hey, we're making this to scale, like, huge-ass RX-93, you know, life-size Gundam. So they wanted to do one for the New Gundam because it's also an iconic unit from Char's Counterattack. But the backpack on it is too fucking heavy. There was no way they were going to feasibly make this one-to-one scale of the New Gundam. So
it has, like, no fin funnels then, I guess?
So it does have a fin funnel, but its backpack now is one singular big-ass fin funnel. And that's this RX-93FF. So they are making this life-size New Gundam, but it is this new model with just one oversized big-ass fin funnel as its backpack.
Is that the last thing that they showed in that like that one trailer once? It's to like advertise it.
Yes, before? Yes. And it was also added to an Extreme Versus 2, I believe, Cross Boost added RX-93FF as a playable unit. It was also very, very good unit. And I think Extreme Versus Overboost added the Rising Freedom Gundam from the Seed movie. And that was also was very, very good. You're very competitive. So those are the five announced units that they showed in this trailer. They also put up I don't know if it's the final roster, but at least a significant part of the roster on the Japanese site for Gundam Breaker 4 of like listing like all the units you'll see in the game. I don't know if that's like final, but it's a huge amount of units. Also, one of the interesting parts about this game is that they're actually going to integrate SD Gundams properly for the first time. So you can always play SD Gundams in Breaker 3 to a limited capacity. You have to like properly match all the SD Gundam parts and just like make like a straight up like Night Gundam, for example. I don't think there was like a mix and matching whatsoever with other SD Gundams. I could be wrong on that, but you definitely could not mix and match them with like properly proper proportion sized units. You couldn't mix and match like, you know, proper, like, you know, properly sized Gunpla for like SD Gundam sized. But because of the scaling feature in Gundam Breaker 4 that lets you like do fine adjustments, like the size of a part by part basis of like how big or small any given part is on your mech, you can now properly mix and match SD Gundams with the rest of the cast, which is really fucking cool. So you can like have custom SD Gundams if you wanted. We're just with normal parts on like normal size Gunpla and just like scale them down like to a smaller size like SD proportion size, or the inverse of having SD Gundam parts onto like properly sized gunpla units, and you can like scale them back or forward depending on how you want your unit to look like. And on top of all that, they announced, you know, like the SD Gundam lineup in this with the Leo, the Jin, like the grunt units from Gundam Seed. These are not the SD Gundam. Sorry, these are just other things that were on that list. But some of the SD Gundams that they showed off was Command Gundam, Knight Gundam, like the Liu Bei Gundam, Musha Gundam, etc. And then like for other new units that are weren't like properly shown in the video are like grunt units like the Jin from Gundam Seed, the Zaku Warrior from Seed Destiny, the Perfect Strike Freedom from Gundam Breaker Battlelog, etc. And Super Fumina also from Gundam Build Fighters Track. So I'm getting into the weeds. I'm sorry. I'm very excited. August 29th, coming to PlayStation 4 or 5, Switch, PC via Steam.
You're going to play the Switch version, right?
No. I'm playing the PC version.
I remember when this was announced in a Nintendo Direct. And of course, it'd be announced for Switch. It's like, please be for other platforms.
Awesome. Everyone get begging on their knees, like, please. And then when they showed, hey, it's also coming to PC, it's like, oh my god, it's going to have, like, awesome high frame rate. Thank god.
Hopefully no buffering.
Yeah, hopefully. God, fuck. Yeah, so August 29th, I'm very excited. I'm definitely going to play it. Hopefully they send out review copies if they are, you know. Hoping I get one. We'll see. And they showed off, not in the trailer itself, but they showed off like a few gameplay tweaks to the full game. The most common complaint from the closed beta test that I played and, you know, other people have played is like there's a thing called option parts in the game where if you used one, it'd have like a universal global cooldown for the other parts, which is really, really annoying because like if you wanted to like chain like different option parts together, like in previous games, you couldn't do that because they were all had a universal cooldown. So now they reverted that change so that each option part has an individual cooldown instead, which is very good. So that means you can do like custom combos from option part into like a regular move into an optional part. So you don't have to wait for a universal cooldown anymore to use another option part, which is a really, really good change. There are other minor changes not worth mentioning here. That's the most significant one. That means we're so fucking back. It's looking better than ever. I hope it's the best Gundam Breaker game ever. And yeah, crossing my fingers. And that is August 29th, once again. And lastly, we have an official release date in the West for Reynatus, September 27th. So Reynatus is officially coming to the West on September 27th. The Japanese release date for Reynatus is July 25, so not too far out.
That's pretty typical for these Furyu games. Yeah. At least the last couple have been like a few month delay for the English release.
So and then of course Reynatus being heavily set in Shibuya, they kind of teased this on April Fools having a crossover with Neo: The World Ends With You. It's like, oh, cool, you know, April Fool's crossover, you know, haha, you know, because, you know, Neo: The World Ends With You, also very heavily set in Shibuya. Well, that is official. In Reynatus, there's actually official in-game crossover content with Neo: The World Ends With You. There'll be, like, some subquests that you actually see Shoka from that game inside Reynatus.
It's really, really funny because you're seeing just straight up, that's the Neo: The World Ends With You model, but it's not using the shaders from Neo: The World Ends With You, and it's in the Reynatus engine. So it looks like if somebody like hopped into VR chat with that model, pretty much.
I never thought of it like that, but you know what? I can see it. Yeah.
You know, I have absolutely zero interest in this game until this announcement.
I imagine that's how it is for a lot of people.
That's probably the point.
Yeah, like, hey, well, a lot of people are...
Well, that's also me, but also, to be blunt, Neo: The World Ends With You did not sell well, so I wonder how much that's actually going to move the needle.
Dude, I really... It's gonna be, you know, it's gonna be interesting to see the comparisons between like Raynaudis's like, you know, average users on Steam through Steam charts versus like Neo the World Ends With You. People are gonna do this when that game comes up and do comparisons of like how, you know, obviously how badly mismanaged Neo the World Ends With You was in its release on Steam, because, you know, we had this chat in staff chat not too long ago where there are still some people, some of my friends still didn't know that, you know, that Neo the World Ends With You came out on Steam. They were like, oh, that came out on Steam? It's like, yep, it sure did come out on Steam.
A lot of people don't even know it's been out on PC since a few months after launch.
Yeah. It came to Epic like a month after
like a month and a half. Like it was like a July release for consoles, and then it was like a September, August. Yeah. So it's
something like that.
September. Yeah, September, I think. And it was an Epic Games Store exclusive, and then they literally shadow dropped on Steam. One thing I found out recently is that Steam does not by default let you shadow drop games. So that meant that Square Enix had to basically beg Valve to let them shadow drop Neo the World's End, like World Ends With You. Which the end result was, most people still think that game is a console exclusive.
Even us who are deeply in the trenches of like following game releases and their release date drops, like there is no foreshadowing or any internal like behind the scenes like communication with outlets on like, hey, this game is gonna drop on this date. It was like we got the press release and we're like, hey guys, this game is out on Steam now. It's like, wait, what? Like, yeah, here's the press release. It's like, today? Like, yeah. Like, okay.
And I mean, like, Square Enix did the same thing or a very similar thing with Dragon Quest Treasures. Just like, it's on Steam now. And based on just history, I halfway expect them probably coming up relatively soon here just to one day just randomly say, Dragon Quest Monsters 3 now on Steam. And just
usually it takes about 6 months. Yeah. So like, I would imagine that. Yeah, probably. I'd say the middle of June, right during the middle of Summer Games Fest, they're going to shadow drop it on Steam, and we're not going to know it even happened because we've been so absorbed with all the other news. It's going to happen. Book it right now.
Look, surely President Kiryu of Square Enix will not let this happen again moving forward, right? Surely there has to be some part of the strategy. It's like, hey, this is not a good strategy. We should probably stop doing this and at least convey it beforehand that we're going to do this.
They're going to waste their entire budget on Infinity Strash Part 2.
So I can't say what game I'm referring to because it's technically under embargo still, but I recently did a preview event for a port of a game. Well, and the fact there was an in-person preview event for this, and yet Square Enix keeps just shadow dropping your stuff on PC when arguably in the current day, PC is the biggest platform for RPGs, just never ceases to amaze me.
Oh man, Square Enix works in mysterious ways. Maybe it'll be less mysterious moving forward after the restructure, but we'll see. We'll see what the fiscal year report has to say, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that is the week in game releases and news for RPG site. A lot was covered: industry news, fiscal year reports, and you know all the other release dates and trailers and updates to upcoming RPGs. We'll see what the next week has in store for us. Are there any other notable new releases coming this week that we know of at the moment that aren't being shadow dropped or being released out of nowhere? This upcoming week?
Let's see. We have Dread Delusion.
Okay.
Neptunia. The newest Neptunia game comes out this week.
Ooh. Holy.
Game Maker Revolution. And a Toho Genso Wanderer Foresight game, which is like, that's like Bullet Hell action RPG, right? I might be wrong.
Well, no, the Genso Wanderer, I think it's the latest in the Mystery Dungeon one.
Oh, that's the roguelike one. Never mind. I'm getting it mixed up with a different sub-series. Okay.
It's okay. There's a lot of Toho.
Another game that I was slightly interested in checking out this month, but remember like a month ago when I was saying, man, May is going to be the perfect time for me to tackle my backlog?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Apparently, a bunch of smaller games are like, oh man, there's nothing coming out in May. We should release in May. And then they all came out in May.
Well,
just that plan backfired.
That's how it goes. I mean, I know Chao is still very excited for the Trails of Cold Steel Northern War mobile game coming out. So, you know.
I'm going to evolve it.
And, yeah. We'll see what other things, if there's going to be any other industry news this upcoming week. Hopefully good news, if there is.
I would be shocked if Phil Spencer didn't say anything, like, at the beginning of next week. Like I said, it's striking that he has said nothing so far, so... Especially with Hellblade 2 coming out, like, it... We'll see.
He's recording and doing auditions for the Xbox event coming next month. So, you know, the busy guy.
Yep. Yeah, but his base got nuked in Fallout 76, and he just finished the quest line so they can nuke them back.
Well, you know, he's got a little bit of free time here and there. Just a little. Anyway, thank you for listening to the TetraCast. If you've made it here, thank you very much. If you have things you like or dislike about the podcast and want to leave a comment, leave us a comment on your favorite podcast app or on the site, wherever. You can find us on rpgsite.net. That is our main site. You can find us on Twitter/X over at rpgsite. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/rpgsitenet. Our YouTube, where our podcast episodes are uploaded, on youtube.com/rpgsitenet. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, your favorite podcast app. You can find us on Discord, discord.gg/rpgsite, where, you know, our community expressed a lot of very, very strong feelings over the developments on the news and more over on that. Go communicate with them, have fun with them. They do a lot of, they share a lot of crazy stuff. Over there, have a lot of conversations over there. That is discord.gg/rpgsite. And until next time, thank you very much, and you all have a wonderful evening, weekend, morning, wherever it is you are on the globe. And thank you.